Good Wednesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM, Patriot 125 and more. Fueled as always by Hornady Ammunition and coming to you, like we do most days, from beautiful Farmville, Virginia. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, thanks so much for being a part of the program today. On the show here in about 20 minutes, we've got Brandon Morse of Red State joining us. He has issued a reminder to the left that they started this war of words with the NRA, not the other way around. Also, John Cardillo from Off the Cuff, from the Rebel, joins us later in the hour. We'll talk with John about what's going on in Tampa, Florida, where there are concerns about a serial killer on the loose. As you might imagine, that has some folks thinking, you know, now might be a good time to get my concealed carry license. Sean Davis of the Federalist with the latest on the revelations that the DNC and the Clinton administration, or the Clinton campaign, rather, apparently paid for this Steele dossier, this dossier supposedly about Donald Trump and Russia that BuzzFeed ended up publishing like 10 days before the election. Yeah. Yeah. Apparently, this was put together by GPS or Fusion GPS, the founders of which have taken the fifth when they appeared before a congressional committee. But now we know that apparently the DNC, the Clinton campaign, picked up the tab for this investigation and this dossier that was leaked out to, we don't know how many press organizations, again, BuzzFeed running it in its entirety. Despite claims that the campaign had nothing to do with this, David Murtosko at the Daily Mail with the headline, "A Year of Clinton Lies About the Quote, Golden Showers Dossier Exposes Hillary's Lawyers Under Fire for Falsely Denying Paying for It." Mark Elias, he writes, brokered a deal between the Clinton camp, the DNC, and opposition research firm Fusion GPS to dig up dirt on President Donald Trump as he was running for office. A pair of New York Times reporters said Tuesday night on Twitter that Elias and others had lied about their ties to the arrangement. New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman, tweeting after the Washington Post linked the dossier to Elias and his firm Perkins Coie, Maggie Haberman wrote, "Folks involved in funding this lied about it and with sanctimony for a year." Kenneth Vogel, a longtime or another Times journalist, formerly with Politico, tweeted, "When I tried to report this story, Clinton campaign lawyer at Mark Elias pushed back vigorously, saying you or your sources are wrong." When they weren't, they were right. I know. Shocking, isn't it, that folks involved in the Clinton campaign would have lied bold-faced to reporters for a year. And that apparently many members of the press actually just took that denial at face value. Right? Okay. Well, thanks for telling us that we're wrong. As David Murtosko writes, the deal began in the spring of 2016 when Mark Elias was approached by Fusion GPS. It lasted right before Election Day. When Fusion approached the Clinton attorney, it had already been doing research work for Trump on an unnamed client during the Republican primary. But apparently that work did not involve anything having to do with Russia. That came later, after the Clinton campaign and the Democrats, using Elias as a middleman, had picked up this effort once again. That's when they hired Christopher Steele, who used to work for MI6 in England, and he put together this this dossier. And again, for a year, oh, this dossier was, by the way, turned over to the FBI. So now there are questions about whether the FBI was using the material in this dossier, compiled by Fusion GPS, to unmask any of the individuals associated with the Trump campaign to do some extra digging and spying. I mean, this story is not surprising in one way, because you kind of figured that something like this might have happened. But I'll tell you the really interesting part about this was actually seeing the reaction from New York Times reporters last night on Twitter. we were lied to. And you could tell they were kind of shocked that they were just lied to their face. I don't know why they would be. But is that going to be enough, perhaps, to shock them into now doing some digging? Again, we'll talk about it with Sean Davis at the Federalist next hour. Seton Motley of Less Government. I suppose one headline from Drudge here, this is from the Daily Caller, journalist downplaying the Trump dossier revelation. So that maybe will tell you what you need to know about how the media is handling this. Anyway, we'll talk about it with Sean Davis next hour. Seton Motley from Less Government next hour as well says we need to undo Obama's America Last State Department policy. Also in hour three, Sean Maloney of Buckeye Farms Association. We'll talk about some legislative news in Ohio, where the state house yesterday passing a pro-carry bill. Also a city council member in Cincinnati who is a gun owner, concealed carry holder, apparently does not really believe that his fellow concealed carry holders deserve right to carry reciprocity because he's arguing against it. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media will join us in hour three as well. Plus, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy of the day. Speaking of guns for me but not for thee and that kind of attitude, Kim and Kanye's mansion in L.A. burgled. Apparently, they're in Bel Air. According to reports, this is from CapitalFM.com, the Los Angeles house broken into 4 o'clock in the morning, 20th of October. Police reports claiming that the intruder entered the grounds, cleared out 3 of Kim and Kanye West's cars. A man believed to be the intruder caught on CCTV, later chased off the grounds by on-site security. Robert did not make it inside the couple's living quarters. It's also reported that the security were forced to draw their firearms on the intruder before they ran him off the grounds. That's scary. I'm glad. Cameron, aren't you glad that they had armed security there to protect them? Kim and Kanye did, and their family?
I think one of the articles that I read about this, I think it noted it's 24/7 armed security. I mean, it's best of the best.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that they have it. I mean, that's good for them. You know, clearly their safety is something that they're concerned about and they're thinking about it, and good on them. I wish more people would, you know, take their own personal safety and security seriously. Now, listen, here's the thing, though. Like, we can't all afford 24/7 security forces, right? I mean, I don't know about you. I can't. I can't hire anybody. Not even at, you know, forget like the fight for 15. I couldn't pay the minimum wage when I started working, when it was like $3.35. I couldn't do that to pay for armed 24-hour guards at my house. And you probably can't either. If you can, God bless you. But most of us can't. However, most of us, in fact, I would say all of us, still have that same right to protect ourselves and our families. And if we don't live in a palatial estate, we don't live in a gated community, we don't live in a place where there's a bunkhouse for our round-the-clock armed security to take naps or sleep in shifts, if instead we live in a row house or a duplex or an apartment or a single-family home, we still have that right to protect ourselves. You know, our right of personal protection isn't based on our annual income. It's not based on the tax bracket. It's not based on our zip code. It's not based on how famous we are. It's based on the fact that we have a human right of self-defense, and we have a right protected by our Constitution to keep and bear arms for our own individual safety and for the safety of those around us. Kim Kardashian West, you know, has sided with Everytown for gun safety very publicly in favor of all kinds of new gun control laws. And there are a lot of other celebrities that Everytown is courting. I saw Eddie Vedder wearing an Everytown T-shirt, Cameron. It didn't totally surprise me, but, you know, they're going for every celebrity that they can possibly get. How many of those celebrities have their own armed protection? Maybe not all of them. I'm guessing a fair amount do. Certainly when they go out to their award shows and they're walking the red carpet, they're protected by people with firearms. And if you can afford it, you probably do have your security team We know that the guy who started Everytown for Gun Safety, Michael Bloomberg, does. I mean, heck, when he retired as mayor of New York, the news reports at the time were that he hired away something like almost like two dozen NYPD officers to serve as his personal Praetorian guard. And again, good for him. He's got billions of dollars. He can afford it. What's not good is people who take their protection very carefully, very seriously, who want to deny others that same right to protect themselves. That's, I guess, the newspeak way of saying it. That's double plus ungood. To be so hypocritical as to say, you know what, my life deserves protection. And my kids deserve protection. And I'm going to hire somebody to provide that protection for me because I can afford it. If you can't afford it, you're out of luck. I don't know of anybody. I've never run across the American who thinks that celebrities or billionaires are somehow entitled to rights that you and I don't possess because we're not famous or we're not fabulously wealthy. No, I mean, that's one of the things about, you know, all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. All of us are created equal, endowed with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. You don't get extra rights when you get a million followers on Instagram, when you cross the 5 million mark on Twitter. You don't get extra, like, bonus citizenship points to spend on self-defense or things like that. This is something that we all have. Well, this is something that we should all have as a right. Unfortunately, we do still have those celebrities, those anti-gun billionaires and others who are quietly trying to keep that right to themselves. You know, it's not even that they want to get rid of that right for all. Clearly, they just want to get rid of that right for some of us. They won't give up their armed guards, but they will demand that you give up your ability to defend yourself and the people that you love. And if you don't give it up, they'll demand that it be taken away. All right. Brandon Morse of Red State, he's going to join us here in just a couple of minutes. Also, we've got some legislative news for you this afternoon from Massachusetts and Illinois to get to. So, again, all of the day's top Second Amendment stories. But when we return here on Cam and Company, Red State's Brandon Morse, a reminder to the left that they started this fight with the NRA. This Brandon Morse talking about the latest Dana Lash video. Says Lash verbally spanking the leftist media for their moral sanctimony while they purposely lie or mislead people that they believe to be stupid. And the media response, of course, has been, oh, this is awful, awful, just awful. This is horrible. Brandon says the left likes to claim that the recent NRA ads have nothing to do with guns. Says that's an asinine assertion. They have everything to do with firearms. They're a response to every lie the media tells about firearms and every leftist that stands on these still warm bodies of those shot by criminals, shouting that the NRA and the right are to blame. And this is nothing new, by the way. I mean, you want to talk about how the media has started this fight. That goes back more than, you know, last week or last month or last year or last decade. I mean, this has been the case for more than 30 years. The media trying to portray the NRA and its members, meaning you, as the worst of the worst. More problematic than the actual criminals committing violent crimes. And that, despite all of the other changes that we've seen within the media over the last three or four decades, that actually has been one of those things that's sort of remained a constant. And we'll talk about it with Brandon Morse of Red State right after a quick break. So stick around. There is much more Cam and Company still to come.
Speaking to Peter Churchborn about NRA online hunter education. Peter, welcome. Tell us, what's it all about?
So at the NRA, I'm sure a lot of you know that we do a lot of programs to help hunters in the United States. But about 3 years ago in the Hunter Services Department, we decided we wanted to do something to help the dwindling numbers of hunters getting into this industry. So As you might know, the NRA started hunter education in 1949. We were the organization that supplied all the training to new hunters for almost 22 years in the United States. So it was just natural that we got back into the business of hunter education. So for the past 3 years, we've been developing a new all-encompassing online hunter education course that we are going to give away free to every person in the United States that want to take hunter education.
Wow. Sounds like a good deal. So tell us, Peter, a little bit about the program.
Sure. So there is standards that's set by the industry of what hunter education has to be delivered in every state. Every state also has a little bit different twist on how they want it delivered in their state, but we're willing to develop anything that they need into our online course. Currently, our online course is available in Florida and soon to be coming in Oregon. We've only had it launched for 60 days, and we hope to have about 7 states using our course in their state in the next 5 months.
That's awesome. Speaking with Peter Churchborn, NRA Online Hunter Education, exciting prospects. So, Peter, this will continue to grow, and we'll continue to follow that growth with you. So how can people get more information about the program?
Sure. It's very easy. Go to www.nrahe.org. That's the landing page, and it will direct you to every state that we have and any more information that you might need.
Excellent. Peter Churchborn, NRA Online Hunter Education, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on the program.
Here at the NRA Carry Guard Expo in Milwaukee, we're talking with John Ryan here at FN America, the beautiful booth here. John, good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you, too. Thanks for coming out and check out the booth.
Absolutely. Talk about what you have here to show us right now.
All right. Well, we are at the Carry Guard Expo, so while you see some of our awesome carbines on the wall, one of the things we want to talk about today is handguns. So I'm going to start with two of the guns we have out today. So the first is the FNS-9C. We launched this about 2 years ago. This has been doing really well for us. It's a striker-fired 9mm. You can also get it in 40 with and without a manual safety. But what a lot of people like about this gun is you see it comes with a more flush carry magazine in a 12-round configuration. It'll also accept our 17-rounder with a sleeve on it, so you can use that as your second carry mag. You can use it for the range, or even a lot of people tell us when they get home, they swap the magazines, and then you have your nightstand gun.
All right, so what else you got?
So that's a 3.5-inch barrel. What we launched at the NRA annual meeting this year in Atlanta was the FN-509. So this is our newest striker pistol, and this is a variant of the gun we submitted for the modular handgun system competition. Still a very carryable size in 4 inches. This does get you a full 17-round capacity. We've had great reception to this today. A lot of people like it just because of the size of the gun, really good ergonomics. We have a lot of different texturing in here for, you know, not only does it fit your hand well, but you're not going to lose grip of it. Comes with a new sighting system that we launched with this pistol, so it's a much more upright sight for better precision. Full rail, very durable, accurate, reliable gun. So definitely check either of them out at fnamerica.com and just enjoy the show.
Yeah. Very good. I appreciate your time. You're John Ryan, FN America. Hold them both up one more time to get these beautiful handguns on camera here at NRA TV. Appreciate your time, and thank you very much, John. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Coming to you once again from a beautiful Farmville, Virginia, where, by the way, we have a new bakery that just opened up on Main Street like a block away. They do donuts every morning. So, Cameron, I'm just going to need you to call me, if you don't mind, about 8:15 and just say no. If you would, just issue that reminder for me. Just, that's all you have to do. Just call me, say no, and then you can hang up.
I'm putting it in my phone now.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Just that little angel on my shoulder in the form of Cameron Gray. No. Brandon Moores from Red State is with us on the program right now. You can find Brandon on Twitter at TheBrandonMoores. Brandon, how are you, sir?
I'm good. And if you guys could issue me a no order pretty much all throughout, like every hour on the hour for donuts, I would really appreciate that. Killer intro music, by the way. That's one of my favorite songs.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. You know, I'm going to come up with an app for that. It'll be called the No Nut. And it'll just, you know, it'll just be a reminder that you can issue on a regular basis. And it'll just be like a talking donut that'll just pop up on your phone and say, no.
Don't do it. Yeah. There you go.
We need an app like that for the media every time they try to rip into the NRA and its members. Just don't do it. A little talking donut pops up. No,
Don't go there.
Don't ruin your career.
Might be helpful, right? Your latest arrest date, a reminder to the left that they started the war with the NRA, not the other way around. Now, it should be noted, I think it's fair to say that you and Dana Lash are friends, or certainly colleagues. I've seen you on the Blaze many times before. And so Dana's latest 60-second commentary spot for NRA TV shows up, and as usual, the media loses its mind. Right? And again, you know, what the media loves to focus on is, well, I can't believe she said it the way she said it, as opposed to what it is that she's actually saying here, right?
What always bothers me is that for the longest time, the media has been attacking the NRA if it breathed out the wrong nostril. Every time a atrocity happens, immediately everyone on the left, celebrities, activists, politicians, they point at the NRA and they say, this is their fault. And like bullies, they just expected the NRA to take it. And the NRA stopped taking it. They started hitting back. And like a bully, the media and the activists and the politicians all recoiled in horror about how mean the NRA was being. I will remind everyone on the left who has been attacking the NRA for years that they are the ones who initiated this war. I mean, they blamed everything on the NRA. Every shooting is blamed on the NRA. Just before I got onto this in this interview, some guy was saying that the NRA killed all the children at Sandy Hook. No, they didn't. That was a crazed gunman. But whatever, dude. You'll recall that they have they blamed you guys for the Ebola scare. They recently, I was just on the other day with you, tried to paint your insurance program as murder insurance when that's not even remotely the case. You have to be proven innocent in a self-defense shooting before that insurance will take effect. They tried to rope you guys in during that ABC thing where they put children – they basically put guns in children's hands and said, oh, look, your education program isn't working. They try to scare people using you as a monster in the media. They paint you guys as monsters. And then they're surprised when you guys strike back, when Dana Lash calls them out and says, look, this isn't going to happen anymore. You guys are proven liars. We're gonna take you down. Now, they immediately say something along the lines of, oh, she means to lead NRA and the NRA members in violence against us. No, that is demonstrably false. No one has from the NRA has said that there needs to be any violence toward anybody. The whole entire idea is to stop the violence.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, Brandon, to me, there's an interesting corollary to how the media typically responds. We saw this week the former CEO of NPR, what's his name? Ken Stern.
Yeah, Ken Stern.
He's got
a
book out, Republican Like Me, How I Left the Liberal Bubble and Learned to Love the Right. He said that he spent a year doing stuff he doesn't normally do, like going to NASCAR races. He went hog hunting in Texas. Absolutely. And he was on, I think he was on MSNBC yesterday, and he was asked, you know, was there anything that you changed your mind on? And he said, yeah, guns. And eventually he said, you know, I don't know what these gun control laws would do. And if you want to pass them, pass them. But I don't know what they would do. So I don't know how much he really changed his mind on guns. But, you know, he said that he had never really thought about the fact that violent crime was going down in this country for 25 years, even as there were more legal gun owners. You had more concealed carry holders. I don't know why it took him leaving the quote unquote bubble to figure that out. But I'm glad that he did. You know, the media doesn't have to. Well, it is, but that's, you know, you can get out. You don't have to stay there. You don't have to do the same thing over and over and over again, which, by the way, is the definition of insanity. You know, they try to portray the NRA and its members as monsters, as you say, hoping that is somehow going to move the needle and will lead to additional gun control legislation. It hasn't worked.
No,
right?
It hasn't.
I don't think it's going to work.
No, I mean, every time a shooting happens, Americans instinctively know that the left is going to immediately, I mean, say what you will, but they've trained us well, the left has. We know instinctively that they're just going to come at guns and try to do what they can to make sure that we have less rights. That's why people go off and they buy guns by the boatload. All right. You are not ever – the whole entire idea of a gun-free America is a pipe dream. All right. You people – I don't know any gun owner who doesn't have a plan to hide his gun should the Second Amendment fall. They plan on keeping their guns. But here's the thing. These aren't criminals. These aren't monsters. These are people who use their guns for all sorts of reasons, be it hunting or self-defense. All right. If every gun owner in America, like the left likes to portray us, or NRA member for that fact, actually was a violent criminal, America wouldn't exist. All right. There would be dead in the literal dead in the streets that everyone likes to talk about on the left. All right. We are good, law abiding people. All right. And I'm sick and tired of hearing the left try to come at not just the NRA. Here's the problem. When they come at the NRA, they're coming after their members as well. They're trying to portray everyone as violent, as criminals, as people who just, you know, want to shoot first and ask questions later. That's not the case at all. All right. If there's these are the same people who can't tell an AR-15 from a shotgun. So the idea that they're coming at and not just the NRA gun owners, even if they're not NRA members, drives these people to basically just defy the left and their gun control measures left and right. Gun ownership is never going to go away here in America. We will never be Australia. There is no chance of that happening whatsoever.
I would agree with you. And I would say that, frankly, the people who say – let me put it this way. I think 90% of the people who write, why don't we be more like Australia – they don't actually know what happened in Australia, and they don't really know what's going on in Australia right now. You know, Australia just had another quote-unquote gun amnesty because they say that the number of illegally held firearms is increasing again. Now they're saying that they need more gun control laws. They need to set a limit on the number of firearms that people can own, which, by the way, is something that Julianne Moore, the actress, has personally endorsed as well. But, you know, they just toss these things out, right? These phrases that have almost become like the anti-gun memes. They're just empty talking points. You know, well, why don't we more like Australia? Well, do you know what happened there? Well, I know that they banned a lot of guns. And that's about as deep as they get.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much more complicated. It's more complicated than that. People in Australia are allowed to own guns. It's just way more complicated to do so. But to think that Australia is completely gun-free and crime-free now, just I think it was last month or maybe earlier this month, two dudes went on a crime spree with guns shooting at police, you know, hijacking cars, stuff like that. I thought that wasn't supposed to happen in a gun-free zone. How does that work? Over 98% now, I think it is, of the shootings that have occurred since the 1950s happened in gun-free zones here in America. If you want to look at the safest places, like I've always said, you know, no one tries to shoot anyone up at a gun shop. All right. I've hardly ever heard of anyone trying to start anything at a gun show. I know that I like to make it a point for people to know that I'm armed. No one has messed with me or tried to break into my house. And, I've got a lot of enemies online, you know? So guns work. All right. Guns keep people safe. That's it. How often are guns used in self-defense? A lot more than they're used to kill people. I know that. So if you're asking me who the real villain here is in terms of gun control for safety versus gun rights for safety, I'd say the real villains are the gun control people who want to basically take people's ability to defend themselves in the best way possible away from them.
Talking again with Brandon Morris of Red State, I think the villains are the criminals. And I think a lot of, here's the thing. I think a lot of people in this country who say, oh yeah, I like that gun control law. They're not gun owners. They don't know a whole lot about the issue. They don't think a whole lot about the issue. They just think, well, yeah, it's not going to impact me. And yeah, I mean, if this is illegal, then, you know, we'll have less of it or we won't have it at all. And it's this very sort of shallow, thinking. I'm sure I'm guilty of it on some issues. But I think that their heart is in the right place, because I think most Americans, at the end of the day, what we want, it's not that we want gun control or we don't want gun control. We want safer societies. We want to be able to exercise our rights, right? But we don't want to live in a police state. But we want safe communities. We want our kids to be able to play on the streets or in our front yard.
And I agree with that.
And that's what we want no matter where we live. To me, it's a matter of actually getting those folks engaged in a conversation about, listen, I'm a gun owner and I want exactly the same thing that you want, because at the end of the day, that's what we're talking about. Now let's talk about how we get there. Right. Because as you talk about some of the proposals that we've seen over the last couple of weeks since the attack in Las Vegas, Brandon, I don't know how you'd implement them. So I don't know why somebody would spend, you know, hours developing this argument that is completely impractical and is completely unworkable. Why don't we talk about things that we can do, things that actually work, and go from there?
I completely agree with you. I do take issue with the people who, A, don't want to have that conversation. Their mind is made up and they will not hear reason. You could literally have the facts staring them straight in the face and they will still deny you they won't award you any points in your argument. They have decided that guns are bad. There's nothing you can do or say to change their mind. I don't think that these people are actually looking out for a better society in this case. They are actually working toward our detriment, whether they know it or not. I would say that if we are to, and you are correct in this, if we are to make our society safer, to make sure that guns are that we're more educated about guns and not just promoting blind fear of them like many of these groups like to do, like Moms Demand or Everytown. We have to find a way to communicate to the people. Not just that guns, yes, guns are dangerous, but they are the safest thing, or the thing that could keep you the safest. If operated properly, if you educate yourself enough about them, that's great. And that's what the NRA tries to do. And so it's kind of funny how people try to paint the NRA as this cabal of evil, you know, that is trying to basically arm every single citizen, including criminals. That's not the case at all. But to open up that conversation with regular America, If we could find a way to do that, that would be absolute gold, because then they would push out the people who I call villains, the people who don't care, who want to take your guns no matter what. I would, whoever could do that, if we work toward that goal, we would have a not just a polite society, but a thriving one.
Brandon Morris from Red State. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, man. It's always good talking with you.
Thanks a lot, man. Good to be here.
You bet. We'll do it again. We'll do it again very soon. The Brandon Morris on Twitter, redstate.com. We've got John Cardillo coming up here in just a few minutes. Also, shameless plug time. I kind of wrote about this at America's First Freedom this week in my Cam's Corner column. And using Ken Stern, the former CEO of NPR, as a springboard to talk about how the media gets us wrong, both intentionally and unintentionally. You know, when Ken Stern, the former NPR CEO, went hog hunting in Texas, he was hanging out with a group of guys. He said that, none of them fit the caricature of the angry NRA member. One was a Hispanic ex-soldier. One was a young black family man. There was a Serbian immigrant. Ken Stern described himself as a Jew from D.C., and they're all out there hunting hogs in Texas. He said, you know, he's looking around at these gunners like, well, none of them really fit that stereotype of the, you know, angry NRA member. And as I write, very few of us do. Even those who, you know, superficially may fit the caricature, the bearded, let's say, the ball cap wearing, the kind of chubby guy, who lives in rural America. Right. We're all supposed to be bumpkins. We're supposed to be slack-jawed yokels. And yet, I can tell you, we're not. The media insists that we are because we have to be. It's easier, again, for us to be monsters if we are some sort of other. Right. So we have to be racist, even though I have cut family members out of my life who could not accept the fact that I was raising biracial kids. We have to be homophobic, even though we've had folks from the Pink Pistols, Operation Blazing Sword, other pro-LGBT gun groups on this program before, and we will continue to do so. We have to be sexist, even if we are married to incredibly strong and independent, badass women. right? We have to be these things because if we're not to them, they lose their best argument. Because their best argument as gun control advocates isn't, look at how well these gun control laws are doing. Because they really can't make that argument, right? Can't make that argument in Maryland, where they're looking at a record high number of homicides. Can't make that argument in California, where despite the gun control laws, the new ones that go on the books every year, violent crime is increasing in the state of California. Their best argument is, look at how awful gun owners are. And so, yeah, they're going to be dishonest about who we are and why it's so important for us to speak up and speak out about who the gun owners across this country, who the NRA members across this country really, truly are. And, you know, Brandon talked about those folks who don't want to listen and how frustrating it can be. And he's right. But, you know, even with those folks who don't want to listen, they don't have that open mind, you can sometimes make inroads with those who might be paying attention to the broader conversation that you're having with that person. And you can provide them with information and knowledge that they're certainly not going to get from the closed-minded anti-gun individual. And you might be able to actually help change at least get somebody to think about this issue in a slightly different way. All right, when we come back, John Cardillo is going to join us from Off the Cuff at the Rebel. Going to talk about what's going on in Tampa, Florida, where there is concern about a potential serial killer on the loose. And I have seen several local news stories quoting individuals either talking about how glad they are that they are a concealed carry holder or thinking about becoming a concealed carry holder. We'll talk about this with John Cardillo coming up right after a quick timeout. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company's on the way.
I'm here with Eric Lipp with the NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. I always love talking about Eddie, and Eddie is representing today. He not only is here, he's got his cool shades and the whole nine yards. So let's talk about what is the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program.
It's very simple and straightforward. It's a firearm accident prevention program for young kids. Everything centers around Eddie's very important message. If you see a gun, stop, don't touch, run away, tell a grown-up. We work with kids pre-K through fourth grade, and we try to get that message out to communities in very many ways.
So how did Eddie Eagle come about? And let's talk a little bit about the history, because Eddie Eagle has taught, what, 29? The message has gotten out to 29 million kids?
Yeah, we're over 29. We're real close to knocking on that 30 million doorstep.
And how long has the program been around for?
29 years.
29 years. So
we're knocking
on
about a million kids a year.
And 30 years. It's a great, rich history. So how did it all start?
So it started off with, you know, the need for safety. We realized that there wasn't anything out there to address child or children and firearms, and the NRA saw that need. And as with many things in safety and firearms, we decided to fill that void. So we used curriculum specialists, school people, law enforcement agencies, firearm instructors from our own organization, and we put all those heads together and came up with this great program.
It is a great program, and sometimes there's pushback from some people. It's like, well, this is the NRA. Why should we do this? And you've got a pretty straightforward answer for that.
Yeah, I think we can all agree that teaching safety to kids is important. We're not here to talk about the NRA when we talk Eddie Eagle to schools and kids. It's not on our integrated materials other than the little tiny copyright mark that is kind of forced upon us. But, yeah, it's not there to talk about the NRA. We don't talk about whether guns are good or bad, just that they might be around some households, that whether it's your own household or households that you may visit. And just like any other message, you're going to teach your kids not to talk to strangers, not to play with matches. It's another same deal.
It's common sense, education. It's
and that's and that's the biggest word. You know, we don't get much argue back. Once you look at our materials, it's
right.
Hard to argue with. It's common sense.
All right, so let's talk about those materials. Talk with Eric Lipp, by the way, with the Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. So Eddie has recently gotten a wonderful kind of a little facelift, and he's now online.
Yep.
And tell us a little bit about getting to those web assets, and then you have some other ways you can get any stuff too.
So, you know, we have a long, rich history. Like we said, we've always had a workbook for kids, goes along with a sticker, and then usually some information for parents because, you know, first and foremost, we want parents to talk to their own kids. You know, this is an important issue, and just like anything else, we want parents involved. So we've had these traditional materials for a long time. Like you said, we got a new facelift lift for Eddie. He's got a new cast of friends.
Yeah.
They have his own little neighborhood park and everything. And they're out there trying to teach other kids and learn the right message.
Yeah, it's a great video, by the way. You go to the website. Tell them the website. But I've watched it. You and I were talking before the interview.
Yep.
Watched it a bunch of times. He's got a
catchy,
cool little cast of friends, you know.
Yep. So, yeah, we created in the past 2 years, EddieEagle.com. Houses our video, but in addition to our video, we have some storybooks for kids to go through. We got a safety quiz for them to take. There's coloring activity pages, and it's really made for a family to use together. So you can go on there with your child, watch the movie, take the quiz, and then continue that education through storybooks and other things that we found a lot of kids are really, really enjoy. And it's one of those things that, like, it's almost like every night before bed, what story are we going to do?
Yeah.
So we're real proud of what we got out there. But like you said, we also do have the regular movie. When a school calls us, for example, you know, we supply them with a movie for the school to keep
right
at the school library. And then we got great workbooks for each kid. So, you know, we try to give them a workbook for each child and parents' information to go home with that child. And then student instructor information for the teachers.
And the parents from the main page have a place they can go for the parents-only part,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yep. There's a parents tab. They can go in. They can learn information, some tips about talking to your own kids, tips for talking to other parents. You know, what do your neighbors have in their houses? You want to make sure you're safe. Your kids are safe with going to other places' houses. And that's why you want to focus on education.
Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program, a great part of the community. Tell folks how they can get more information again about Eddie.
Super, super easy. Go to EddieEagle.com. The video is there. Everything for kids is available. There's also a tab for grown-ups that we mentioned. So if you click on that, it'll give you all the resources for parents. And then at that point, they'll even give you a contact page. So if you really want to contact us at headquarters, we can give you whatever you need.
Awesome. Eric Lipp, NRA Eddie Eagle Gun Safe Program. Thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having us. We love being here.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Next hour, about an hour from now, actually, Seton Motley going to join us from Less Government. Says we need to undo Obama's America Last State Department inanity. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Mr. John Cardillo from Off the Cuff at the Rebel and a former New York police officer. John, how are you, sir?
I am doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. All right, so Tampa, Florida, opposite side of the state from where you are, but I know this is still big news all across the state.
Yeah.
In the past 2 weeks, within a one-mile radius in the Seminole Heights neighborhood of Tampa, there have been three people who have been shot and killed. Police say that they don't have a motive. They don't have a suspect. They think that the shootings are linked by proximity and time frame. None of them were robbed. I mean, that's the thing. They can't figure out a motive here, and so now there is speculation that there is somebody who is perhaps a serial killer that is preying on right now this neighborhood. I guess the big question in Tampa is where might this individual strike next?
Yeah, it's tough, right? And it's reminding people down here of the D.C. sniper case. Random shootings. The victims didn't have anything in common. There was no robbery involved. So I think this is a pretty scary one. On the upside, you've got pretty good law enforcement agencies up in that area. Tampa PD is real proficient. The surrounding sheriff's agencies are very good at what they do, and they've got their share of busy areas, so they're no strangers to violent crime. But that's just it, right? It causes public fear because it's so random.
Absolutely. CBS in Miami talked to Mahed Fokaha, the owner of the M&M Market in the Seminole Heights neighborhood. He says that he has his concealed carry license. He says that he has his gun at his store when he's working. He says when he walks out to his car at night, has his gun in his hand. He says that, you know, business is down. People are staying away because they are afraid. And I'm sure that more than Mr. Fokaha, you know, you've got other concealed carry holders, who I imagine are making sure that they're not leaving the house without protection. And I'm guessing, and I haven't talked with any firearms instructors in the Tampa area, but I'm guessing, John, that this is probably prompting some people to think about getting their concealed carry license.
Yeah, most definitely. And look, that's a pretty red area. Donald Trump won that area pretty handily. The local politicians, the Republicans, the more conservative win there. So that's a pretty high ratio of concealed carry holders to residents, I would venture a guess anyway. A lot of friends who live over there are big hunters. They're outdoorsmen. They carry. So I would think that you're right. Most people are probably carrying. Those who aren't are probably getting prodded by family members and members and friends to go get their CCW and start carrying.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, at this point, when police don't have a suspect, they don't have a motive, you know, obviously they're going to be interviewing folks in the neighborhood to see if they heard anything, if they saw anything. At this point, how reliant might they be on outside tips, people calling into the police department saying, hey, you know, I think I might have seen somebody, versus canvassing that neighborhood, John?
I think they're going to be looking heavily at all types of incoming content, right? Tips are outstanding, but they're going to be looking at traffic cameras. They're going to be asking residents if they could take a look at what their security camera on the front of the house might record, at local business security cameras, things of that nature, right? I mean, even people who are just walking around, they might be putting out an inquiry. Hey, if you were walking on the street and you took a pic of your boyfriend, maybe you caught something behind him, you know, in the back of the scene. So they're going to be probably relying on technological evidence as much as they are tips being taken in by the hotlines.
Talking again with John Cardillo at the Off the Cuff from the Rebel about this potential serial killer in Tampa. And by the way, the media was the first, I think, to ask and use that phrase, serial killer. The police chief, this was at a press conference, the police chief basically said, we can call it what we want. If that brings attention to this, that's fine. That was the police chief, Brian Dugan. You know, so again, I mean, we don't even really know for sure that this would be one suspect, but the indications might be that that there is one individual responsible for all three of these crimes.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're not letting out certain info. I assume they have ballistics that have indicated that and prevented them from saying, no, these are three different shooters. Doesn't appear the victims had gang or criminal affiliations. And so with those two elements in place, I'm thinking it's the same gun and that police are running on the premise that it's the same shooter.
You know, if you are dealing with a serial killer, John, somebody who it feels whatever for whatever reason is driven to crimes like this, is there an element of – I know sometimes at least there's an element of of taunting the police, of almost not necessarily wanting to be caught, but you know, putting stuff out there because there's this sense of invincibility. How much commonality is there within the typical – a serial killer or this typical mindset? Are there commonalities across, you know, most of these incidences, or do you really have to start from scratch every time you're trying to build a profile of who might be committing these types of crimes?
You know, it's interesting. I had a conversation about this with my cousin, who's a forensic psychologist and builds these kinds of profiles with regards to anger issues, homicidal issues. He had worked with corrections departments, things of that nature. And it's a little bit of everything, right? He said that these incidents typically require some type of motivation. We were talking about this case, and we were talking about the Las Vegas shooting, and they require some type of motivation, whether that motivation is radicalism with a certain religion, Islamic radicalization, what have you, or the victim reminded that person of somebody who wronged them in their life, and they're taking out past aggressions on them. So in that sense, you do have to start from scratch, and you try to build that profile on the assailant. Now, they're also going to be looking at geography, right? Where these people are shot. Is there a commonality there? Is it equidistant maybe from an on-ramp or the exit ramp of a highway that it makes ingress and egress, you know, an escape route much easier? But right now, it's preliminary and so random. You know, you and I have spoken about this. These random asymmetrical incidents are the ones that keep law enforcement up at night because they're impossible to predict and very, very difficult to solve.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I hope that law enforcement catches a break in this case and are able to make an arrest very quickly. In the meantime, John, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's good talking with you today.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Speak soon.
You too, sir. John Cardillo, again, host of Off the Cuff from The Rebel on Twitter at John Cardillo. Sean Davis from The Federalist joining us next hour talking about the revelations that Russian dossier put together by Fusion GPS, actually apparently funded by the DNC, the Clinton campaign. And an interesting catch, I think I saw this at Hot Air earlier today. This might have been Ed Morrissey. Brian Fallon, formerly of the Clinton campaign, May still be among those Clinton campaign staffers who is still getting a paycheck, because apparently there are still individuals who were working on the Clinton campaign who are still getting paid, even though the Clinton campaign no longer exists. But Brian Fallon yesterday had made a comment about Hillary Clinton not knowing about any sort of relationship. And so he was on CNN and was asked by, I think this was Poppy Harlow. Okay, so she didn't know anything, right? And he says, well, I don't know if that's true. I haven't talked to her. I don't know what she knew. Then said she may have known about the dossier and where the funding was coming from. May have known. Again, doesn't know. Hasn't talked to her. But this is not the denial that I think the Clinton supporters were hoping for. In fact, at Hot Air, there was a note this way, and this was Ed Morrissey. He noted that Brian Fallon on Twitter last night was talking about Mark Elias, the attorney associated with the Clinton campaign, who sort of served as the middleman between the Clinton campaign, the DNC, and Fusion GPS. And Brian Fallon said, I don't know what Elias may have said, because remember, he denied to several reporters very specifically that the campaign was responsible in any way for this dossier. Brian Fallon says, I don't know what Elias may have said, but if he was coy, he was probably just being a good lawyer, honoring confidentiality. Keep in mind, he said, Steele was an ex-spy who basically took his life in his hands to mine Russian sources. I'm not insulted. It was considered need to know. Now, as Ed Morrissey points out, need to know doesn't exist in the private sector. Right? I mean, possibly, you know, you could find a boss that would, you know, use that phrase, but that's not really a thing in the private sector. Well, that's on a need-to-know basis, and you don't need to know. Okay. As far as good lawyer honoring confidentiality, as Ed Morrissey points out at Hot Air, a good lawyer honoring confidentiality wouldn't have made any comment. He would not have specifically denied something that was true, because that's a lie. What a good lawyer protecting his client would have done would have been to say, I'm sorry, I can't discuss that. Right? And he says, Ed Morrissey does, furthermore, by the time that Mark Elias was asked about this, Steele's role was public knowledge and had been for some time. Meanwhile, Callum Borchers of the Washington Post notes Hillary Clinton specifically relied on the dossier in her book, What Happened? I still love that title, because I always put a question mark. Don't you put a question mark, Cameron, when you say the title of Hillary Clinton's book? It's not. There's no period there.
Never.
No. What happened? Yeah. So she argued in What Happened to that the Russian interference cost her the election without ever revealing that her campaign had a hand in its creation. Hillary also argues that the dossier was linked to the FBI decision to seek the FISA warrant, which again, and now we know that this dossier came from the Clinton campaign, or at least was bankrolled by the Clinton campaign and the DNC. And as Callum Borchers of the Washington Post says, Clinton wanted the dossier to be viewed as credible, yet she did not want to be connected to it. She hoped that the media, before Election Day, would publish claims about Donald Trump to which she was unwilling to attach her own name. And the media did, to the point that BuzzFeed actually published this entire dossier 10 days before the election, even though they said, we haven't been able to verify any of this. We don't know whether any of this is true, but it's been going around, and so here you go. Just, you know, take it with as many grains of salt as you want. We're just going to go ahead and publish this, even though we haven't been able to verify any of it. And there had been portions of that dossier that had been dropped and floated to media outlets. And some of them had run with little bits and pieces. Others chose not to. Not everybody decided to run with this. BuzzFeed did, by the way. And again, Hillary Clinton hoping that all of this information would get out there, not wanting to have her name attached to it, and going so far, again, her attorney going so far, as to deny that they had anything to do with it. What happens next? I mean, you know, the media covers this is going to be interesting to see, but how Congress responds is probably of much more concern, I would think, to Hillary Clinton. And we'll talk about this again with Sean Davis of The Federalist coming up next hour. In hour three, Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media, Sean Maloney with Buckeye Firearms Association is going to join us. And, you know, we were just talking earlier this hour with Brandon Morse from Red State about the media going after the NRA and how long they've been doing that. 1982, the I Am the NRA campaign began. The print campaign featuring, you know, full-page ads, Charlton Heston. There was an 8-year-old boy who was part of that first ad. And as it turns out, the New Yorker, National Geographic, Texas Monthly all refused to run that I Am the NRA ad because even back then, they were going after the NRA.
What this program will do is it will take you from somebody who has a gun and might have a gun on your hip to somebody who is proficient in using that gun.
I would say I'm still in the beginner's phase in a sense that I didn't really start doing any official training, going to classes until about a year ago.
If I were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as proficiency, I would say I'm under 5. That will change because I have made that decision to become as proficient as possible.
With a handgun, I've got a lot more experience, so I'm a little bit better shot. With a rifle, Caitlin is a better shot because of all the experience she has had.
I've been fortunate enough to do a lot of shooting and be in units that have done a lot of shooting. So when it comes to the legality of it, the responsibility of it, and then when it comes to the actual physical training, I think it's awesome.
I have a lot of experience in firearms, but from high-level instructors, they just have infinite knowledge, and it's really nice to learn from people like them.
You know, I've done some classes before, but these guys really break it down into every little step so that you're able to really hone in every little movement.
They all have similar backgrounds, but the diversity in each of them and the stories and experiences they've all had are ideal for someone like myself to walk into this experience.
Oh my gosh, it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime experience getting training from these amazing guys out here. Gotten so much more out of this than a couple weeks of shooting on my own.
There's things that I've done that are fast. There's things I've done that look good. There's things I've done that work in certain scenarios. These guys are teaching a way that works every time. The heavy burden that you carry, carrying was where I learned the most.
The right responsibilities is probably one of the more important parts of what you can learn.
On the range and off the range, you know, just knowing what the laws are, how we need to think, the mindset that we need if you are carrying a gun, that it is a big responsibility.
A lot of that information was eye-opening to me, and I hadn't heard it instructed that way, I hadn't heard it presented that way, so it was very educational.
You can always go to the range and shoot at paper, but this class brought in different elements that you don't always do, like low light shooting.
Statistically, things happen mostly after dark when you would need to use your firearm, and so that's a really important skill that I need to have.
With Airsoft, it really helped wrap the whole training experience together, brought the adrenaline level up, the realness of the scenario.
I think it's the best way to learn. I think you can tell somebody something so many times and you can look at it on paper so many times, but until you get that real tactile response and that adrenaline and that situational scenario, there's no better way to learn.
When the whistle hit and Derek started running, when I pulled out my gun out of my holster and shot, you could see the distance that he got on me, and that's such a huge reality check. So as parents, this class is really great. The more tools that we have, you know, to protect our kids and our family, I think the better.
This program is great for everyone. I think it's great for someone like me that's carried a long time and had a lot of shooting experience, and I think it's great for someone that's coming in and this may be the only class they take.
Made in America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady. You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right this second. John Davis of the Federalist, Eaton Motley of Less Government on the program this hour. Ariel Edwards Levy, no relation, polling director at Huffington Post Politics, just said on Twitter, Dems, this is a new poll out. Democrats now have a favorable view of George W. Bush, 51-42. And for those of you who were paying attention back during the George W. Bush administration, you understand why I'm laughing, because, I mean, gosh, that was we heard Bush Hitler, right? And Chimpy McSmirk, and oh, he was awful. And now, great, 51-42. Apparently, all you have to do is be a Republican, former president who's a Republican, and all of a sudden, your approval ratings go up among Democrats. Weird how that works. Pew out with a survey today asking Americans, do you think your side is winning? Do you think your side is winning in terms of politics? Whether you're on the left or the right, as it turns out, the Pew Research Center said that basically you think you're losing. Whether you are on the left or the right, more than 6 in 10 Americans say that they believe their side is losing more than it is winning on the issues that matter most. Only about 1 in 4 think their side is mostly winning. Huh. Isn't that interesting? Now, what would account for this? The idea that folks who identify as on the left and folks who identify as on the right would feel like they are losing here. You know, I can think of a couple of things. If you are on the left, you look at control of Washington, D.C. Republicans control the White House. They control Congress. You can say that the Supreme Court is a conservative court, although I think that it's still very much a 5-4 court, and depends on what issue it is that you're talking about, that the court is, 5-4. What side they fall down on. You can look at the number of state house seats and governorships that the Republicans have taken over the last 8 years under Barack Obama. And you might feel like you're losing ground. And you'd be right. You know, politically, you're losing ground. If you're on the right, what would make you feel like you're losing? Again, you've got the White House, you've got Congress, but you haven't gotten big pieces of legislation to President Trump's desk. You might feel that culturally you're losing, that you still see more celebrities speak out in favor of things like gun control than the right of self-defense. Even when those celebrities are employing armed guards, they still seem to chime up for more gun control as opposed to being able to protect yourself and the people that you love. I suppose, you know, there are areas in which the left and areas in which the right are both winning and both losing. But it is interesting that, again, the majority of Americans feel like they're on the losing side right now, which, may in some measure account for the toxicity of the current state of politics. I mean, if you feel like you're losing as opposed to, winning, are you not just more defensive? Are you more apt to lash out, to get angry? if you feel like you are in danger of losing on these issues that that you feel so strongly about. Maybe. I don't know that it accounts for all of the toxicity, but it is kind of interesting that, you know, 6 in 10 Americans say that they don't feel like their side is winning right now. And I don't know, unfortunately, that Pew asked, and it might have been hard to poll this question, what would winning look like? If you don't feel like your side is winning right now, what would winning actually look like? If you are the left, does it mean passing legislation? Does it mean just, you know, taking back control of Congress, winning back some state houses? If you're on the right, does it mean getting big pieces of legislation to President Trump's desk? Does it mean Hollywood changing its ways, not just when it comes to reprobates like what we've seen, the Harvey Weinstein crowd, but, you know, the anti-gun attitudes and the sneering contempt that Hollywood has towards much of middle America? Would that be a win? I'd consider that a win. If the NFL adopted a policy that said, okay, everybody's going to stand for the national anthem, would that be considered a win? Do you feel like your side is losing when it comes to respect for the flag? I don't know the answers to this. But I also wonder if, because we are a fairly closely divided nation on a lot of these issues, that also helps you feel like you're losing. Because maybe in a lot of these issues, we're kind of fighting to a stalemate. And in that situation, right, nobody's winning. So maybe that would account for it. Speaking of winning and losing, congratulations, Cameron Gray. And sorry to you Astro fans out there.
What a great night. What a great first night. Looking forward to game two and another win. I'm going to say, I predicted Dodgers in five for the last series, and I was happy. I said Dodgers in six, because I can't imagine the Astros won't win a game or two. But it's a great series. No one knelt. It was a great national anthem. It was a fantastic national anthem by a gospel singer. I wish I knew his name. It's fantastic. Fox had the shots of the flag and the flyover. It was just, the hairs in the back of your neck were standing up. Seventh inning stretch, God Bless America, which I saw pissed off some liberals, which you're going to be angry about that. Well, okay, you can be angry about anything. But no kneeling, no politics. It was just a glorious all-American sporting event. Good sports ball, as Kurt Schlichter would say.
Hopefully the ratings will reflect that. Right. I'll be very curious to see what the ratings for Game 1 are like. And I didn't watch last night, and you know, not that Major League Baseball was missing me, but I had other stuff to do around the house, so I didn't watch it. 102 degrees, I heard, game time, which, you know, nothing screams fall classic like a triple-digit beginning to Game 1 of the World Series there. But was there a Vin Scully appearance at all last night, Cameron? Was he in attendance at least?
Of course, he was definitely in attendance. They showed him. They did, you know, it's L.A., so you got to do the obligatory, here are all the celebrities at the game. So they started with Tommy Lasorda, of course, and Joe Buck, who, you know, give or take Joe Buck. I know there's a lot of Joe Buck haters, I whatever. But he actually said something very cool. He said, there's Vin Scully, the greatest person to do the thing that I'm attempting to do right now. I thought that was pretty cool. It was very cool for him to acknowledge that. And, of course, you know, whenever they have the big games, they always bring on, like, someone who's show they're promoting. Hey, look who's happens to be in the stands. Hey, look, it's Seth MacFarlane. The Orville is coming up Thursday.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, hopefully, if the Dodgers win this year, you won't have Jimmy Fallon run out on the field with Drew Barrymore and ruin your World Series experience.
Yeah, I think this is unless, you know, knock on wood, wherever there's some wood in the studio, this is a non-ruinable series. I mean, I just don't anticipate any problems, any protests, any flare-ups. I mean, this just seems like this is just a really great matchup. And you talked about the weather. They showed the graphic at the last six World Series, and it was like 103 in L.A. And the one in last year, I think it was Cleveland, they said it was 50. So it was at least a 50-degree difference. So these poor people at the pregame shows, they were sweating like crazy. It was it's definitely hot out there. Just great stuff, great entertainment, great sports, and just what America needs right now is a great sporting event that hopefully can bring people together, even if you don't like the Astros or the Dodgers.
Absolutely. I mean, I know it's not. We were talking about this, you know, last week, and I know it's not Dodgers Yankees. That might have been the matchup that, you know, more casual baseball fans wanted. But
I was thinking about that too, because I think that this might be actually, and I agreed with you then, but now that the Astros are in the series, and you have the whole Hurricane Harvey backdrop, and they have the on their uniforms, they have Houston Strong patches, you know, right there, so you can see it every time a batter comes to the plate. So I think there you can add that into the mix too. You know, when you look at how, you know, the J.J. Watts of the world, the five living presidents, you know, when they got together, you know, the tens and tens of millions of dollars that people put together, and the hardships that people endured in the city of Houston, it kind of, you know, if you're not a Dodgers fan or a baseball fan, you can kind of root for Houston as a comeback city. So I think that's going to add a lot to it too.
I think you're right. And I mean, look, just for as far as, you know, good baseball goes, I mean, both teams winning 100 games. I think this is the first time in 40 years that you've had a World Series with two teams that won more than 100 games. I mean, that pretty much guarantees you're going to get, you know, some really good performances. Unfortunately, Deadline Hollywood reporting that the ratings are down for game one of the World Series in metered market ratings. It scored a 10.2, a rating, a 17 share. That's down 19% from last year's World Series opener when the Chicago Cubs lost to the Cleveland Indians. It was also down 3% from 2015 when the Kansas City Royals beat the New York Mets on October 27th of that year. So Deadline Hollywood says last night's game faced a new This Is Us. You know, Cameron, I'm sorry. If we've reached the point where a new This Is Us can derail the ratings for the World Series.
We got bigger problems.
I'm going home. I'm giving up.
You know, and you say it's the matchup of the 200 win teams for the first time in 40 years. It does go to the argument, you know, a lot of people talking about the decline in sports ratings overall, and a lot of it, you know, because of Trump, some of it because of the anthem, whatever you want to ascribe it to. But there is a school of thought that it is because of something you talk about a lot too, is the fracturing of our consumption of entertainment. And, you know, if people are watching the game on Twitter, they're waiting for the MLB or one of the teams to upload the latest home run. Millennials have short attention spans. They don't want to listen to John Smoltz talk about, you know, the cutter. I mean, they want to, hey, show me the home runs. So I think as the years go on, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, politics aside and all the other reasons aside, just the way that we consume and digest media. Is you can do it through so many. Yesterday, the entire broadcast was sponsored by YouTube TV, and the ads were so effective that I canceled Xfinity and got YouTube TV. I cut the cord because it's just so great. You don't need all these dumb channels. You don't need to spend $200 a month for cable. It's $35 a month. My wife and I, we get the local channel, so all we watch is Jeopardy and the news, and it's great. It's got it. Now I'm paying for YouTube TV, so this is not a free ad, but it's just another way people are watching these games, and unless I'm mistaken, you can't get ratings from YouTube TV. You know, it's just another way to watch.
Not
this.
Nielsen, no. Yeah, you're right. No, I mean, you wouldn't get Nielsen ratings. And I don't know if I guess maybe they'll go back and they'll try to figure out the streaming numbers, right. But those will come later.
Right.
So you mean to tell me, though, you're watching television, and you're watching cable television, and you're seeing ads for don't have cable television, and they were so persuasive that they actually caused you to cancel.
Yes. They were that good.
Well, you were actually what? Wow.
Well, no, I didn't. I watched the rest of the game.
Well, obviously not right. I know you got to have a little switch off period. Yeah.
But I signed up for the service. It's that compelling, you know, to cut the cord. Just the cost alone. And when you're someone like me and my wife who doesn't watch, you know, all these channels, just, you know, the Bernie Sanders movie. There's too many channels. We don't watch any of them. We watch Jeopardy, news, and sports, and that's it. This takes care of it, but it's just another way. You know, how many ways can you watch a baseball game now with the apps and you can watch it on a PlayStation? It's the days of the big, other than maybe the Super Bowl, the days of the big viewing, you know, America comes together to watch, they're just in the past.
Well, and I'll tell you, like, this year's Super Bowl halftime show anyway, there's nothing for me. I'll be watching Puppy Bowl.
We got to talk about this for 1 second. As somebody who worked in terrestrial radio at the time,
yes.
Was it 2004, I think? And I worked on the station with John
Pop.
You're
correct.
We worked here in D.C. on a station called WJFK. It was an FM talk station. It was a killer station at the time. It had Howard Stern in the morning, Don and Mike in the afternoon. I mean, just these legendary FM talkers, you know, but it was like guy talk. It was like all like Stern, that type of content. So Janet Jackson does her nonsense at the Super Bowl. We got the weight of the FCC on because everyone at our corporate at CBS was so afraid of what FCC would hear here in D.C. So we barely could say damn. I mean, for years after that incident, it was a great place to work and it was fun, but you were always so nervous. We suspended people left and right for saying nothing. There were 2 week suspensions. We handed them out like candy because, oh, God forbid we say anything because the world was so nervous after Janet Jackson's boob gate. And now they bring this dummy back on who caused all the problems in the first place. And I'll watch the Super Bowl, but I refuse to watch that. That guy made my life a living hell for years.
Well, at least, you know, it did stop John Pop from showing his nipples. I mean, there is, you know, there is that one.
It's true. Silver lining Edwards.
John in the room. Yeah, there you go. Actually, John was working for us at the time, and I can tell you there were no Pop nipples on display that year. Closest we've had to a John Pop Super Bowl story was when the Patriots and the Eagles played and the Eagles lost, and John Pop had to dress up as a town crier and walk through the streets of Alexandria loudly proclaiming how great the Patriots were. So awesome. There you go. All right, we have to step away for just a moment or two. When we come back, Sean Davis at the Federalist is going to join us talking about this Fusion GPS dossier put together by a former MI6 agent that apparently was paid for by the DNC and the Clinton campaign despite protests and denials for a year now that no way do they have anything to do with it. Yahweh, they actually had a lot to do with it. We'll get to the bottom of this with Sean from the Federalist right after a quick timeout. So stick around. There's more Cam and Company next.
Speaking with Sam Olson with NRA Clubs and Associations. Welcome to the program. Sam, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. We're talking about one of my favorite things at NRA, the Youth Wildlife Art Contest. And tell us a little bit about the contest. What's it all about?
So the George Montgomery NRA Youth Wildlife Art Contest is an art contest designed for kids in grades 1 through 12 to show their creativity with the animals that can be legally hunted and trapped in North America. And it's a little bit different program than what the NRA usually does with shooting sports because this allows a different dynamic of kids who are involved with conservation but are also great artists.
And why was it important that Mr. Montgomery and the NRA start a contest like this? Why do this?
Because it gets a different group of kids involved with the National Rifle Association.
And, you know, I'll tell you what, Sam, I've seen some of the art in the past, and it's great because you've got this wide range of kids from first grade through 12th grade, so you see this really neat interpretations of the way they paint or they present the animals, and then it goes from the simple stuff when they're younger to really quite some beautiful and sophisticated stuff as they get older. So it's a pretty neat thing. So who's a typical kind of person who enters this thing?
Basically, it's anybody. Even the younger kids, their artwork is phenomenal. It's stuff that I couldn't even do. I'm really just baffled with their talent that they have. And it ranges everywhere from, you know, a basic duck to, you know, caribou to bears. I mean, the artwork that comes in is great.
Fantastic. Sam Olson, it's October 31st is the deadline. How do they get more information?
They can go on our website at artcontest.nra.org.
Last summer, 5 Dallas law enforcement officers were killed while protecting hundreds of protesters who marched against America's police. My brother, Mike Kroll, was one of them. No protesters lost their lives. No media were hit by bullets. But Mike was there, protecting, serving, sacrificing, as he did every day for 8 years on the Dallas PD. The National Rifle Association honors such sacrifice. While the media paints our police as criminals and celebrities attack them, the NRA backs our blue. Now you can too. Donate your vehicles to NRA Cars for Freedom. Visit NRACarsForFreedom.com or call 1-866-NRA-GIFT. Donations are tax deductible and will help provide training for law enforcement. My brother gave his life protecting those who marched against him. That's why I back our blue. Stand with me. NRACarsForFreedom.com. 1-866-NRA-GIFT.
My mission in life is to set a new standard by educating, training, and equipping my fellow warriors and citizens to become assets to themselves, their families, and this country. This mindset has led me on a path to become a self-protection expert, and I'm excited to share some of my knowledge with you guys. On this season of Noir, I'll be showcasing some of the best in self-defense, and I'll be showing my techniques in super slow motion. Over the next few months, NRA TV will be releasing a constant stream of interviews, scenarios, and techniques in slow motion. Get ready, guys, because this is going to be a whole new way for you to engage and become an asset.
Welcome back here to Cam and Company on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Seton Motley of Less Government going to join us here in just a minute or two. Also, Sean Davis of the actually, Seton's going to join us here in about 20 minutes or so. Sean Davis going to be with us here in just a moment or two, talking about the latest regarding the Steele dossier. Now, also over at the Federalist, Molly Hemingway has written a piece that's sort of a primer for this, because this story does get awfully convoluted. It goes back over a year. There have been a lot of stories that have sort of dripped out over the past year or so. As Molly writes, what really got the ball rolling on last year's Russia-Trump conspiracy theory was not the dossier itself, but the briefing of that dossier by Obama intelligence chiefs to President-elect Trump back in January. As Molly writes, Jim Comey admitted under oath that the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, asked him to personally brief President Trump about the dossier, and the fact of that meeting quickly leaked to CNN. As Molly says, as confirmed by the Washington Post, this Russia-Trump collusion narrative was a Clinton campaign political operation. The dossier itself, shopped around by Fusion GPS a year ago to the New York Times, the Washington Post, Yahoo News, the New Yorker, CNN, eventually BuzzFeed ended up, putting this online 10 days before the election. Molly writes that the dossier was so unverifiable that the only reporter to bite on this was from Mother Jones. And she says, given the dossier's many problems, was the entire purpose of the meeting to produce the leak that the meeting happened. No one was biting on this dossier. It needed legitimization by the opponents of Trump if the dossier was so shoddy that it was debunked in hours after BuzzFeed posted it in all of its salacious glory. Why brief the president and president-elect on it, much less leak the fact of that meeting to the press? What was the real purpose of that meeting and that leak to CNN? Here to talk about this and more, Sean Davis of the Federalist. Sean, how are you, sir?
I'm great, sir. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming on the program. I'm hoping that you can help shed some light and illumination on this story, because, you know, it really does seem, Sean, like what we've learned just over the past 24 hours kind of turns this whole Trump-Russia collusion story on its head here.
It really does. I think what we're learning is that when the Clinton campaign and all their cronies and their friends in the media were accusing the Trump campaign of colluding with Russia to meddle with the 2016 election, what they were actually doing was projecting. They were accusing Trump and his campaign of doing all the things they were doing. I mean, let us not forget that some of the most salacious claims in this shoddy dossier were provided by Russian government sources, several of whom may have even been paid for their information. I find that shocking. I'm shocked that the FBI actually did pay Steele, the guy who put this thing together. I'm shocked that they used it as a basis for wiretaps. I'm shocked that they used it as a basis for a meeting with the president-elect for the sole purpose of leaking the meeting and the dossier, you know, seconds after it was over. The whole thing stinks to high heaven.
It does, as does some of the media reaction to this. I know that you got into it with Jake Tapper over a tweet that Jake has since deleted. But, you know, one of the pushbacks that we've seen, I don't know if this was coordinated or not, but we've seen a number of people making this that, well, you know, listen, this wasn't this was originally funded by the Republicans. And explain that if you can, Sean, because this does get a little convoluted. But at the bottom line is, no, this really wasn't funded by Republicans. What actually happened here?
Right. So what we have been told, according to anonymous sources, and I think it's very important to add that caveat, because if something can't be independently verified, we can't really go out there and say it's a fact or it's true. But what we have been told is that Fusion GPS was retained during the primary by a wealthy Republican attached to one of the campaigns, and Fusion GPS was retained to do general oppo research on Trump. At some point in spring of 2016, either in March or April, that contract between this unnamed Republican and Fusion GPS ended. It wasn't until later, when Fusion GPS was brought on by a separate client, who we're now being told was the DNC and Clinton, that Steele was hired. And it wasn't until after Steele was hired that the dossier began to be constructed. So the claim that, well, a Republican actually paid for the dossier, there's no evidence of that, and not even the people who were leaking the notion of the Republican claimed that. All we have been told is that a Republican initially retained Fusion GPS to do oppo, and then much later, long after that Republican was out of the picture and after the Clintons and the DNC were allegedly funding it, that's when Steele was hired, and that's when the dossier began to be compiled.
Okay. And you know, your colleague at the Federalist, Molly Hemingway, 10 Things to Know About This Dossier, points out that a lot of the stuff in this dossier, again, apparently paid for, at least in part, by the FBI, full of all kinds of, and not just unverified information, but discredited information.
Right. I think the most famous bogus claim in there was that an attorney with the Trump campaign had secretly traveled to Prague on a particular date to meet with a bunch of Russian informants or sources to talk about either financial transactions or something to do with the campaign. And it turned out that not only had that individual with the Trump campaign never even been to Prague, but my recollection that he was doing a college visit with his son in California at the time. So, I mean, there's things in there that are just blatantly false. There's other things in there. There are some rather gross sexual details that just strain credulity that were thrown in there. And then you have, you know, media agencies running with it, characterizing it as a largely verified dossier. Nothing could be further from the truth. There's really nothing of substance in that entire thing that was ever independently verified or confirmed by anyone.
And yet, this dossier was everywhere. Now, not necessarily everywhere in print. It wasn't being splashed across, you know, the CNN Chiron or anything like that. But this was in newsrooms across the country, right? This was being floated out to reporters. As Molly Hemingway cites Omri Sarin today on Twitter, said it's genuinely unclear how journalists can report on the Steele dossier without compromising sources and norms. Every major outlet had it. Every major outlet spent weeks trying to lock it down. Every major outlet had it hanging over newsrooms shaping choices. They were all a part of the story. He says that's why reporting now is so tricky. Everybody is on the hook to some extent. And, you know, Sean, this is going to be sort of, I think, undercovered, because the media really hates to cover itself. But how the media responded to the existence of this dossier and what they did with this information, including BuzzFeed posting it online 10 days before the election. That is actually a part of the story, because that is that was part of the design for I think, putting this dossier out there, was the desire and the intent that the media was going to act and respond to it.
Well, yes, and let's look back at kind of the course of events. We had Trump win. We had all the hand-wringing and complaining afterwards. And then sometime in around December, January, the left decided to really put their hooks in on this collusion narrative. And their goal, as we've now seen, was to basically get the president investigated by a super prosecutor with no limits. And there were two things that made that happen. There was the CNN report that James Comey had briefed Trump on the contents of this dossier, that it was that important that he had to be briefed on these allegations, number one. And then number two, Comey illegally leaking to the New York Times the contents of conversations that he says he had with Trump. So you have here, you have something that we're told was funded by Democrats and Hillary. You have the FBI director intimately involved, and just magically, you know, minutes after he does this meeting, it somehow gets leaked to CNN. And then you have Comey again illegally leaking these memos and letters that he wrote to the New York Times, which spurred the appointment of the special prosecutor. We've got some serious corruption here to root out, because I'll tell you, it's not just Hillary and the DNC that look bad here. The FBI looks like an absolute dumpster fire, given the way that it appears Comey was using it during and after the election.
Well, okay, and so to that end, you know, there was this briefing of Donald Trump back in January, and then, as it's been noted, shortly thereafter, the details of that meeting leaked out to CNN. Molly Hemingway is wondering again whether or not the entire purpose of that meeting was to produce the leak that the meeting happened, because nobody was really biting on this dossier. So it does raise the question of, you know, and these are horrible questions to raise, Sean, but how involved was the FBI, or at least elements within the FBI? How involved were they in either intentionally or unintentionally pushing this false narrative out there?
It would be nice if the FBI would answer the questions. You would think if they have nothing to hide, if everything they did was above board, that they would eagerly comply with multiple congressional investigations into the matter. But what we've actually seen is the opposite. The FBI has stonewalled that inquiry, both in the House and from Senator Chuck Grassley, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, over what exactly the FBI was, what they were doing. Who did they pay? Why did they pay them? How much did they pay? When did they do it? How did they get these warrants? What did they use as the basis? The FBI won't even answer committee chairmen in the Senate when they ask these questions, which tells me a lot about what they might have actually been doing, that they won't answer pretty simple questions.
Absolutely. And, you know, you look at some of the responses from those in the Clinton orbit. Tommy Veter on Twitter 20 minutes ago, it's odd how many reporters are upset that a Clinton-linked lawyer paid for the Russia dossier but were fined reporting on materials stolen by Russia. I'm not sure that whataboutism is the best defense right now for the Clinton team, Sean.
But no, and in typical form, you are seeing the Clinton operation handle this as incompetently and ham-handedly as possible. It's just, you watch their response to this, and you begin to see, oh, yeah, this is why they got their clock cleaned by Donald Trump. It's a bunch of corrupt little amateurs who think they can just go and lie and deceive, and somehow people aren't going to see through it.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, for a year, I mean, you had New York Times reporters, Maggie Haberman, Kenneth Vogel. Kenneth Vogel said, when I tried to report this story, Clinton campaign lawyer Mark Elias pushed back vigorously, saying, you or your sources are wrong. Now, that's a lie, apparently, Sean. He and his sources were right, but you've got the Clinton lawyer saying, no, this never happened. We weren't associated with it. Knowing full well that, they were. I don't know why an attorney wouldn't have just said, listen, I'm not going to talk about this. But now the question really does become, what is Hillary Clinton going to say? And frankly, no matter what she says, Sean, why should we believe her?
Yeah, well, I'm shocked that there was lying going on in this Clinton establishment. We've never seen that before. Clinton's lying about a scandal? Oh, my goodness.
Right.
Either he was lying then or he's lying now, but either way, he's not telling the truth.
And what do you think Hillary Clinton's response to this will be when she finally comes out and makes a statement?
I'm sure she'll claim she knew nothing about it, but that the American public deserves answers about what exactly Trump was doing with the Russians. She'll whistle right past the graveyard without addressing any of the substance, and I'm sure she'll do it 2 weeks late.
Yeah, there you go. Sean, listen, we got to run, unfortunately, but thank you very much for coming to the program. It's great talking with you today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
You bet. Sean Davis joins us from The Federalist on Twitter at Sean M-D-A-V. Seton Motley of Less Government on the way here in just a few minutes. Top of the hour, we have today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, good guy as well. So stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company coming up right after this. Talking with Tony Lambrea from Ultimate Training Munitions. Tony, how are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you today?
I am excellent. So what is UTM all about?
So it's Ultimate Training Munitions. We convert real firearms to training munitions, our training munitions, so it'll shoot our stuff, so that you can practice at home, you can practice in your backyard, and you can do things that you normally wouldn't be able to do on a range.
And so, again, you talk about real firearms. You're using your personal gun, right? But you're able to do this by swapping out a couple of components.
That's correct. So, on example, the AR-15 platform, all you do is take the bolt carrier group out from the live gun. You put our bolt carrier group in. It changes from a center fire to a rim fire. And now you're shooting the training ammunition, and it's no problem. Everything cycles the same. Full function, recoil, ejection cartridge, lockback. Everything is exactly the same, but it's completely safe. The rounds are only going 375 feet per second.
Okay, so when you say that you can shoot at home, like you're talking about, like you could set something up in your basement if you've got one, right? And you could actually shoot indoors and actually train on your firearm.
That's correct. So you can train in your backyard. You can train in your basement. You can hang up a target down there. There's no noise. The decibel level is only 113. So now you're training with no hearing protection. You want to bring in a new shooter, teach somebody how to start getting introduced to the firearms, perfect way to do it.
Okay, so how expensive is this? I mean, is this out of the price range of the ordinary shooter, or is this something that's affordable for pretty much everybody?
No, it's affordable for the average shooter. I mean, it's a bolt carrier group is a couple hundred bucks. So, you know, you get the bolt carrier group and the ammunition online. Actually, we have a combined site, UTM-NRA.com. You go on the site. You order from the site, and you're good to go. Get shipped to your house, and you can shoot.
That is amazing. All right, so you've got this for the AR platform. You got this for pistols as well, right?
We do, and depending on the pistol, it's either a barrel exchange or a barrel and slide exchange. So, again, your firearm, all you do is change out the slide and barrel, and once again, live round lockout, completely safe. You're getting recoil, lock back, everything's the same, but you're practicing at the house, no noise.
That is so cool. Is this something that was modified from, you know, military and law enforcement training and then came to the civilian market?
Yeah, we've been doing military and law enforcement for about 12 years. This is just being released to the commercial market now, but it's the technology that we were using in law enforcement and military. So this opportunity, again, full function, as real as it absolutely gets, because that's what we did with the military.
And that's so important from a training perspective, because if you're training, I mean, again, you get the ability to train with your firearm, right? So, but you're also getting the feel, the heft. I mean, again, it's a real gun. It's not like you're using airsoft to try to figure out how you're going to be able to react in a self-defense situation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. These are absolutely real guns, your magazines. Everything is exactly the same, and you're getting the full function on the gun. So it's critical. The other part of that is because you're able to train at home and you're able to train safely, you can do things, you know, draws from a holster, reload drills, 180 drills, things that you would never really be allowed to do on a live fire range. Now you can actually do that. Home defense. You know, you hang targets up in someplace inside your house, and now you're shooting right from your couch, shooting down your staircase, you know, practicing in your home what you would normally have to do if, God forbid, you had to use it.
So what is the reaction when people come out and actually try the UTM for the first time?
I think people are shocked at how real it is. You know, the sights actually move. They jump. The slide is coming back pretty aggressive. So, you know, the realism is really what it is. You know, because a lot of people have shot airsoft and other things like this. And it's just so much more realistic than anything else on the market.
And so the ammunition itself, you talked about how the gun changes, but what type of ammo are you using here?
So we're using a non-tox dual primer, custom primer. So the primer in the back cycles the gun, it creates the recoil. Then the ball comes forward, hits the forward primer, that controls the projectile and the velocity downrange. So on the pistols, it's 315. On the rifle, 375. The technology is such that it actually creates an accuracy. 20 meters, you're drilling tacks. You know, so 30 meters with the rifle, same thing. And if you look online, we have some videos where we were actually shooting steel targets 50 meters in the backyard with the rifle. So you're getting accuracy at distance. You're still able to function the firearm, and yet you have no hearing protection.
That is amazing. All right, so this is the ultimate training munitions. It really is the ultimate training munition. And again, remind folks where they can find this product.
It's on the UTM-NRA.com website, and you can order it online.
All right, again, talking with Tony Lambrea from Ultimate Training Munitions about this incredible product. Again, law enforcement, military have been using this for over a decade, but now it is available to the civilian and the consumer market. So be sure to check out Ultimate Training Munitions. Thanks so much for joining us here on Cam and Company. Coming up next hour, Sean Maloney with the Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors, on a city council member in Cincinnati who is a gun owner and a concealed carry holder himself, but apparently not so fond of Ohio legislation that would help concealed carry holders. We'll talk with Sean about that. Also, Stephen Cruiser, PJ Media. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Less Government our friend Seton Motley. Seton, how are you, sir?
Doing well, sir. How are you?
I'm excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. We need to undo Obama's America Last State Department inanity, leading from behind, right? And what happens when you lead from behind, Seton, for so long, you fall in last place?
Well, it wasn't just that, though. It wasn't just that, you know, he was pulling back. You know, it's hilarious listening to people criticize Trump for not relinquishing America's leadership in the world. Really? After Obama, you're going to criticize Trump for that? But what was going on was the Obama administration was actually actively working against American business interests internationally. They were actually appointing people to State Department positions around the world. They would actually work with local in the world environmental activists and such to undermine American business interests in those countries.
Hey, okay, so you write specifically about Guatemala and a U.S. company called Tahoe Resources.
To Guatemala was actively working with environmentalist radicals in Guatemala and pressuring the government of Guatemala to appoint certain radical judges that would then issue bad rules so that the environmental groups would sue, and then the radical judges that the Obama administration put pressure on Guatemala to appoint would then rule with the environmental groups against the U.S. companies.
That is
unbelievable,
amazing.
And it's true. And they did this, by the way, all over the place. I mean, there's another example I cite very briefly where U.S. Justice Department or the U.S. Federal Trade Commission drafted a lawsuit against Qualcomm for having a monopoly because they have patents. Well, of course, a patent is a monopoly. And then that blueprint, the FTC lawsuit blueprint, was then used against Qualcomm in China and in South Korea. So this is going on in multiple directions. In Guatemala, of course, there's this company called Tahoe Resources. They invested $1 billion in a silver mine down there. The Obama administration went down there, worked with environmental radicals, got them to sue. They went before the judges that the Obama administration had pressured the Guatemalan government to put on the bench, and they in July they issued a stay, meaning they had to stop working on the mine. Well, then they appealed, and the Supreme Court, and it's for some reason the Supreme Court in Guatemala is not the highest court. I don't think supreme translates directly, but
okay.
In English. But the Supreme Court again in September ruled and said, you know what? You can go back to work on the mine pending the Constitutional Court, which is the highest court in the land. They're going to take up the case and render a final verdict on whether or not you can continue mining. But in the meantime, you can mine you can't mine while you're waiting because the environmental radicals are blockading the mine and not allowing the workers to go in and mine the silver.
So it's interesting. Not only are you writing about this, but our friend Andrew Langer at the Institute for Liberty has a piece at the Santa Cruz Sentinel in California about this. And he says to fight gangs in Santa Cruz, you have to strengthen economic stability in Guatemala. He's talking about, and you make this same point, more gigs, you write, means fewer gang members, right? In Guatemala, we have problems with MS-13 here in the state of Virginia and across the United States, but Guatemala has a real problem with MS-13. But if you can give people good jobs, right, and a mining company that has invested $1 billion in a silver mine there, it's going to employ people.
I mean, if that project
and other projects like that can go to fruition. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, it's on the one hand, it's the Obama administration. You'd expect the Obama administration to side with environmentalists. But you've also got to think about, you know, this is the guy who won the Nobel Peace Prize, right? Which isn't about protecting trees. It's about protecting people. So, right. what is more important right now, stopping the silver mine or actually helping the people of Guatemala?
Yeah, and speaking of international bodies, I don't often cite them, but what the environmentalists are doing, the Obama administration aid environmentalists are doing, is in violation of Article 23 of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which says every human has the right to work and freely choose where they wish to work, and these environmentalist freaks are preventing them from doing that. So Mr. Nobel Prize didn't even care about that either. I find it stunning. And by the way, I've heard this in another incident too, where in another Central American country, where the Obama administration's ambassador was actively working against business interests in that country too, with the environmentalist radicals there. This is a problem throughout the world with the Obama administration. It's stunningly obnoxious. And I think Americans, of course, didn't know specifics like Guatemala, for example, but they kind of got the vibe that, okay, that's what's going on, and we're going to go a completely different direction after 8 years of that.
Unbelievable.
It really is. So we're appointing people to work against America's businesses in other countries. It's amazing.
At the same time, though, like, doesn't that kind of fit in with Barack Obama's apology tours to other nations?
Oh, sure.
The idea that
you're
going to be a good global citizen. Like, on the one hand, it is kind of unbelievable. On the other hand, it's not surprising at all.
This is exactly the type of stuff we kind of, you and I, who pay, you know, we pay attention to this for a living, we kind of anticipated this kind of, the one thing that really impressed me about the Obama administration was how thorough they were in applying this leftist nonsense all across the board. I mean, to the point where he's appointing ambassadors to Guatemala to screw American business. That's pretty thorough. That's pretty in-depth anti-Americanism. That's some seriously heady professional stuff.
Absolutely. So how much of this would be easily reversible under the Trump administration? Obviously, I mean, it would seem to be a matter of, appointing different folks to some of these areas. But something tells me it's not quite as simple as all of that.
I mean, the Trump administration, his single greatest mistake was not making more people leave D.C. when he arrived. And, you know, we've got all these appointments. He's appointed a lot of people, not enough. And, of course, McConnell, I don't know what the heck McConnell's doing. Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, he's taking way too long to approve these Trump nominees. I mentioned the FTC. A bunch of dumb, stupid Obama stuff continues at the Federal Trade Commission because it's supposed to be 3-2, Republican commissioners 3, Democrat 2. It's tied 1-1 right now. And so you can't vote to stop all the Obama stuff. It's continuing by inertia. And he's got all three nominees, nominated, but McConnell hasn't approved him yet or hasn't brought him up for a vote yet. So what we can do in Guatemala and a lot of these things is get the Obama people out, get the careerists out. Because this guy wasn't just an Obama guy. He was a career diplomat. So this has been going on at the State Department for a long time, and we got to get as many of these people possible as out, especially at the tip of the spear positions, like the ambassador to Guatemala. Get them out and replace them with people who don't hate America quite so much.
One would think that would be a good first step. Yeah, absolutely. Seton, listen, buddy, I appreciate you coming on the program. It's great talking with you today.
Thank you very much, sir. You're in D.C., is that what I heard?
Next week I will be in D.C.
Oh, next week you're in D.C. Oh, my fault. I kind of half heard what Cameron said. I couldn't make it out.
Okay. Yeah, so if you're up in the area next week, let me know.
Oh, you're going to be in Alexandria?
I will be.
Excellent. Okay, cool.
All right, maybe we'll see you in person, Seton Motley.
Much to your audience's chagrin, yes.
All right, man, we'll talk to you soon. Seton Motley on Twitter, at Seton Motley with us here on Cam and Company. Sean Maloney coming up from Buckeye Firearms next hour. Also, Steven Cruiser of PJ Media going to join us on the program. So yesterday we were talking about Adam Laxalt, the attorney general in Nevada. He had a piece in the Sunday Las Vegas Review-Journal talking about question one. That was that universal background check measure that narrowly passed in Nevada. Only county it passed in was Clark County, I believe. But it squeaked by statewide because of Clark County's vote. And it did not get implemented because of the way that the law had been written. The FBI was supposed to be the body that was going to conduct all of these background checks on private transfers of firearms, temporary transfers of firearms. And the Attorney General, Adam Laxalt, reached out to the FBI. The FBI said, no, we're not going to do that. You can do that if you want through your state point of contact system, but we're not set up to do that for every one of these private transfers. So, no, we won't be doing this. Now, the way that this law had been written, the state of Nevada could not conduct these background checks because this was billed as something that was going to come as no cost to the taxpayers of Nevada. So, as Adam Laxalt explained in the Las Vegas Review-Journal, gun control advocates wrote a bill that could not be enforced, and when it did not get enforced, then they complained that, for whatever reason, it was pro-gun individuals, and it was the gun lobby, and it was people like Adam Laxalt who were preventing their law from taking effect when it was the law that they wrote that is preventing itself from taking effect. In the Elko Daily Free Press in Nevada, Thomas Mitchell, who's a columnist, has another great article about this, about how this all went down. And again, in Nevada, I mean, the narrative that the anti-gun activists are trying to put out there right now is, well, we should have universal background checks, but it's the gun lobby getting in the way. No, they stepped on their own feet, and they screwed up. Or maybe they didn't screw up. Maybe they intentionally wrote a bill this way because they knew that it would stand a greater likelihood of passing if it did not come with a price tag attached. The initiative backers, Thomas Mitchell writes, in order to have in a fiscal note saying what the mandatory background checks would cost taxpayers, something that might cost votes, wrote the new law to say that those involved in a private gun sale must contact a licensed gun dealer, conduct a background check, and that, quote, the licensed dealer must contact the National Instant Criminal Background Check System and not the Central Repository, which is the state background check entity, to determine whether the buyer or transferee is eligible to purchase and possess firearms under state and federal law. The Central Repository, run by the Nevada Department of Public Safety, uses NICS data but also uses state and local data to run background checks. The lawsuit that has now been filed in the state of Nevada over the non-implementation of this law. Thomas Mitchell says, names Governor Brian Sandoval and the Attorney General Adam Laxalt as defendants. The suit asks the court to force the governor to enforce the background check law or, in the alternative, to sever any portion of the law that is invalid or unenforceable. In other words, Mitchell says, you have a lawsuit that is asking a judge to rewrite the law that the voters actually approved. Mitchell says, like most laws, the Background Check Act contains a severability clause that states that if any portion of the law is found invalid or unconstitutional, that should not affect the law as a whole because that part could be excised. But he says the section that the suit seeks to remove was placed there specifically to avoid incurring costs to the taxpaying voters. Without that section, the election outcome might well have been different. So you've got this law that, again, was drafted by anti-gun activists. It narrowly was approved by voters. But the FBI isn't going along because nobody asked the FBI if they would go along with this. And so now you've got gun control activists in Nevada that are telling or asking a federal judge, hey, rewrite this law for us so that this law can go into effect. And, yeah, there is going to be a cost to taxpayers that we didn't talk about, because now the law is going to substantially be changed by you, a judge. See, there's also a provision in the Nevada law that says that a referendum, a law that's enacted via a referendum, can't be changed by the legislature for a period of time. I believe it's 5 years, maybe three. But in other words, if the citizens of the state enact a law, the legislature can't go back and change that law right away. Huh. So the legislature can't provide the quote-unquote fix that the anti-gun activists need. It's not known, by the way, whether the votes would be there in the legislature for a quote-unquote fix, but they can't seek legislative relief. They can't enforce the law as it was written, and they won't admit that either they made a mistake or they intentionally tried to deceive voters in Nevada into thinking that they could have these additional background checks without any additional cost to taxpayers. And now they just want a judge to make all their problems go away by rewriting a law, which is supposed to be the job of the legislature. All right, stick around. Hour three of Cam and Company, Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, and more. It's all coming up right after this quick timeout. Talking with Dave Miles, Director of Marketing for Mossberg. There's a lot of great product to see here, including the gun that you're holding in your hand. Now, this is the Shockwave, right?
Yeah, it's the new Mossberg Shockwave, brand new this year. We launched it in January, and it's just been a huge hit. It's the gun that everybody wants in 2017.
Flying off the shelves here. Can you talk a little bit about this gun?
Sure. Well, it's a unique gun because most people would look at it and say, hey, there's a Mossberg pump-action shotgun. But the truth is, what makes it unique is that it's not a shotgun. It makes it possible. This is the Shockwave. It's got a 14-inch barrel. So if it was a shotgun, everybody would say, well, geez, Dave, that's a short-barreled shotgun. It's not a shotgun.
It's an NFA item, right?
Yeah. Class 3. Yeah, so you'd have to pay $200 and wait 10 months for your stamp to arrive. But because it's not designed to be fired from the shoulder, it's not a shotgun. And so then a lot of people would then look at it and say, well, geez, then it's in any other weapon. And the truth is that it's not that either, because it's over 26 inches in length, and therefore it falls into this category of pistol grip firearms. And so this transfers on a 4473, no tax stamp, no weight, and you can go pick it up at just about every state. It's legal. There's some states that are outliers, but so you do have to know your local laws, but for the most part you can go buy this at the local gun store, and I'll tell you what, a lot of people have been doing that.
That's what I'm hearing. So tell me about the utility for the Shockwave. I mean, what are we using this for?
I would use this. This would be a great home defense gun. It's nice, short, nimble. You can move it around. You can move through doors and that kind of stuff, so it's good for that. Some people say, well, geez, that would be really hard to aim. Truth is, if you spend some time on the range and practice, which you should do with any home defense gun, it's very easy to get on target. A lot easier than, say, a subcompact pistol or something. Put a target out of 10 yards with this, and in about 5 minutes, you're going to be hitting exactly where you want to hit.
How much recoil is there with a Shockwave?
Recoil, it can vary. I mean, if you're using a full-blown home defense buckshot, it'll...
It's got a kick?
It says hello. But if you're not, if you're shooting light target loads or maybe low recoil buckshot, it certainly packs a punch at the muzzle end, but it doesn't hurt the shooter. And it's interesting because of the shape of the pistol grip. When you put your arm up, the recoil comes straight down your arm, so it's actually more comfortable to shoot this than a pistol grip shotgun.
Really?
Or a firearm.
Okay. So this is available now, if you can find them on the mm-hmm. shelf, right? But
yeah.
if you can't, one will probably soon be arriving at your gun store.
Oh, absolutely. They're widely available in distribution. So... If you use one of those gunfinder apps that's out there, you'll surely find one and get one shipped to your local retailer. They're at a lot of retailer shops right now. The good news for us is they get to the shop and they move off the shelf, making room for the next one. But Mossberg's building a bunch of them every day, keeping up with demand, or doing our best to. And so it's not a gun that you're going to have to wait months to get. We just keep making them, and you keep buying them, and we'll all be happy.
What's the suggested retail price on the Shockwave?
Suggested retail is $455. So it's not a super expensive gun.
Yeah.
We're seeing the deal is running probably around $389 around there. So you can find it for less than $400. You're doing great.
That's pretty awesome. Dave, listen, I appreciate you spending some time with us showing off the Shockwave from Mossberg. And look forward to talking to you again here in a few months, maybe at the SHOT Show 2018. We'll
Looking
do it then.
To it. Thanks so much, Cam.
Thank you, Dave.
NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company starts right this second. Fueled by Hornady on the program this hour. Sean Maloney with the Buckeye Firearms Association. Also, Steven Cruiser from PJ Media going to join us on the program. We have today's hero of the day, deal of the day, good guy as well, coming up here in just a matter of moments, as well as more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. As a matter of fact, let's get to our hero of the day from the Las Vegas Review-Journal, actually. We were just talking about the Attorney General, Adam Laxalt, his piece that ran in the Sunday Las Vegas Review-Journal. But Victor Jakes of the Las Vegas Review-Journal with a story a couple days ago. This actually happened back on October the 5th. Justin Pearson stopped a kidnapping from right outside of his home in Las Vegas. The 36-year-old Pearson says, "We heard this real loud noise outside." He said, "I opened up the door and this big BMW goes flying by 60 miles an hour in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. I dialed 911 immediately." Justin Pearson, who is a concealed carry holder, grabbed his firearm, put it on his hip, as he does every time he leaves the house. 911 operator asked for a license plate number. Justin Pearson said he moved down the street to get it. He said he saw that the driver lost control of the car and, quote, almost went into a house at the end of the street. BMW then turns around, stops in front of a neighbor's yard. There's a little kid standing in the yard there. And Justin Pearson said, about 50 yards in front of me, the driver grabs this young child and starts stuffing him in the car. Remember, Justin Pearson is on the phone to 911 this entire time. He said, holy crap, he just took a kid and he's trying to stuff him into the car. Kidnapper, according to Justin Pearson, about 6'4", about Justin's size. Justin says he's kind of a beanpole, and the kidnapper was about 250, a lot bigger than Justin was. He said, he was a very big dude. He said, "I'm not a menacing person by any means. I don't think that I could have physically stopped the guy. It would have been super ugly if it were just me versus him." But it was not just Justin versus the kidnapper. Justin did have his firearm with him. He said, "So I lifted up my shirt and I put my hand on my gun. And I said real loud, 'Hey, stop.' He turned and he looked at me. There was just enough of a delay for the kid to get out of the car. I know he saw the firearm." Victor Jakes of the Las Vegas Review-Journal writes, "With a boy out of the car and an armed citizen staring him down, the man decided to drive away. Pearson and his still-holstered pistol stopped a kidnapping. Police," Victor Jakes writes, "would not arrive for 17 minutes. And again, that's not a slam against the police. They're trying to get there as quickly as they can, but they're not going to be able to get there right away. Victor Jake says a Metropolitan Police Department spokeswoman confirmed many of the details in Justin Pearson's story, including the date, time, location. Pearson said Metro confirmed that the would-be kidnapper was the boy's biological father, who did not have parental rights, did not have permission to take the child. Justin Pearson, by the way, says that this is not the first time that he has used a firearm to stop a crime. He said, many years ago I was carrying and a guy pulled a knife on a friend of mine. I quickly drew my firearm. The kid ran away. Two times where Justin Pearson has used his firearm in defense of another. Both times, the trigger never pulled, like the vast majority of defensive gun uses. And frankly, both of these stories, the saving of a friend several years ago, the protecting of this young child back earlier this month, typically neither one of those stories would rise to the level of getting any sort of news attention. They just wouldn't really be reported. I have not seen, in fact, you know, this story itself didn't appear necessarily in news form at the Las Vegas Review-Journal. This story appears in a column by Victor Jakes there at the Las Vegas Review-Journal. I don't know that any of the local television stations in Las Vegas reported on this story back when it occurred or after Victor Jakes' column has appeared. I don't think if any local TV did, I certainly don't think it went beyond local television. I haven't seen any national news about this, even though you have a man who helped stop a kidnapping. These types of stories, again, do happen every day, but you don't hear about them every day unless you're listening to programs like Cam and Company. Anyway, Justin Pearson in Las Vegas, Nevada, he is today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day from the Daily Advance newspaper in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. A 29-year-old Camden man wanted for allegedly shooting a man in Elizabeth City, North Carolina earlier this year. In custody now after leading Camden deputies and city police on a high-speed chase that ended with a vehicle crash. Darren Roundtree facing a host of charges in Camden, North Carolina following the September 16th incident. Including driving while impaired, felony speeding to elude arrest, and driving while his license was revoked. He's also now been served an indictment that includes charges of assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, discharging a felon into occupied into occupied property, and being a felon in possession of a firearm. Those charges stem from January of this year, when Darren Roundtree is accused of shooting a guy named Curtis Brinkley in the back. In Elizabeth City, North Carolina. A recent check of the local court records shows a brief report by the police department about the shooting. According to the report, Brinkley was standing beside his parked car when Roundtree drove by and began shooting at him, wounding him in the back. Police also alleged that Roundtree had informed Brinkley's uncle a few days earlier that he intended to shoot Brinkley. Now, according to court records, Roundtree has a prior history of violent crime there in the area. 2011, Elizabeth City Police, or maybe this was Camden City Police, arrested Roundtree and two other men, Tyrell Bimbury and Daniel Williams, in connection with an exchange of gunfire in the parking lot of what was then the Mamacita's restaurant. No one injured in the incident. Bullets fired during the exchange hit both the restaurant and what was then the Ace Hardware store across the street. That was in 2011. Fast forward to March of 2013, and Roundtree reached a deal with prosecutors that allowed him to plead guilty to two counts of discharging a weapon into occupied property. The judge in that case sentenced Roundtree to an active prison sentence, minimum of 2 years and a month, maximum of 3 years and 3 months. So, tried to kill people, ended up getting a plea deal, pled down to those lesser charges, but he's at least going to have to do a minimum of 2 years, 2 months behind bars. Right? Yeah, well, this is the deal of the day, so you know the answer to that. Upon issuing that sentence, the judge then suspended the sentence. So you're going to have to go to prison for at least 2 years, 2 months if I were to actually impose that sentence, which I'm not going to do. Instead, you will serve 3 years and 4 months of probation. I'll sentence you to 574 days in jail, which just happens to be the amount of time that you've spent behind bars while awaiting trial. So you are free to go, Mr. Roundtree. Just make sure you stay on the straight and narrow. It's part of the plea agreement. Prosecutors withdrew charges against Roundtree of attempted first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, driving with his license revoked, possession of illegal drugs. He already had a prior conviction record, so he could have been charged with felon in possession of a firearm back then, but he was not. Instead, placed on probation. And now, just a few short years later, Darren Roundtree facing more charges of violent crime. Let's hope that the plea deal fairy doesn't come pay Mr. Roundtree a visit this time around. He is today's deal of the day. Today's good guy from TMJ4 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Green Bay, Wisconsin. Officer Robinson. Don't know Officer Robinson's name, but the Green Bay Police Department is sharing his story. He got a report. This was Monday of this week. Got a report from a local elementary school there in Green Bay, Wisconsin, that there was a child who had not been picked up from school. TMJ says the child's parent is in jail. The school did not have any other family contacts. And it was this kid's birthday. Just imagine that for a second. It's this kid's birthday. Nobody shows up. Parents in jail. Your grandparents, your cousin, whoever it is that you're staying with, they're not there. So Officer Robinson got this call. He showed up. And according to the Green Bay Police Department, thanks to the owners of our local McDonald's, we were given free cheeseburger coupons to hand out in situations. Officer Robinson took the child for a meal at McDonald's, took a ride around in the police car for his birthday. Eventually, family was located. Child was dropped off. Green Bay Police Department says thank you to our community partners like McDonald's that allow us to help others out in small ways during our interactions throughout the shift. And thank you to Officer Robinson for taking some extra time to celebrate the child's birthday. We are proud to have him as part of the Green Bay PD team. Yeah, that has to be a really tough situation for any officer to handle. But Officer Robinson, we thank you for helping make that day a little bit better for that kid. And we thank you very much for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, still to come on the program this afternoon, Sean Maloney of Buckeye Firearms is going to join us. Also, we'll talk with Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media. And, you know, we are now officially less than 2 weeks away from Election Day across the country. You may have local elections where you are, everything from, you know, school board, mayoral elections, you got bond issues probably on your ballot. Statewide elections, there are only a couple of states. New Jersey, Virginia, and that's it this year. As far as, you know, electing a governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, legislative races. Here in the state of Virginia, our state senate is not up, but our assembly is up, 99 seats in the assembly. And the News and Advance newspaper out of Lynchburg, Virginia, had a candidate profile. A lot of local papers doing this around the state right now. Taking a look at the candidates for District 23, specifically their views on the Second Amendment and gun control. And I thought this was kind of interesting, just in terms of the messaging that you're hearing in Virginia. Remember, you know, you've got, it was a Dan Pfeiffer, a former Obama official, who had his piece at Crooked Media. I actually got the name right this time. About the need for the anti-gun advocates to be vocally anti-gun. Call it gun control. Be bold. Talk about what it is that you really want to do. Don't nibble around the edges. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think any of the anti-gun politicians are actually heeding Dan Pfeiffer's advice. They're still saying things like, oh, I love the Second Amendment. I fully support your right to keep your arms, except for these situations over here. Scott Garrett is the incumbent in District 23 in Virginia. He's a Republican. His opponent, Natalie Short, never held office before. And according to the News Advance newspaper, quote, both candidates strongly believe in a Virginian's right to bear arms, they said. though they have some differing views on how to go about it. Ah, Natalie Short, the Democrat, said she's, quote, all about protecting the Second Amendment. I'm all about protecting the Second Amendment. That's great to hear. Scott Garrett said, I think the greatest challenge we have in defending the Second Amendment is not in defining it, but in defending it. Amen. So what about some specifics? Well, Natalie Short, who says she's all about protecting the Second Amendment, also supports a magazine ban in the state of Virginia, so that magazines over 10 rounds would not be legal to purchase. I don't know if Natalie Short, because again, the News Advance newspaper asks these questions, so I don't know that they know enough to ask some follow-ups, but what does it mean to support a magazine ban now? Does it mean that you support a ban on the sale, the manufacture, the continued possession of these magazines? Is this a ban like what California is trying to implement, where if you've legally owned these magazines, you can no longer legally own them? I'll be honest with you, I wouldn't support either one of those magazine bans, but it would be nice to know from a legal perspective what it is that you're actually proposing. Natalie Short, who says that she is all about protecting the Second Amendment, also says that Virginians should only be able to buy one firearm per month. Yeah. So if you want a matched set of pistols, you want to buy a rifle and a shotgun, you want to buy a handgun and a shotgun or a handgun and a rifle, Natalie says no. She's all about protecting the Second Amendment, but no. One gun per month. Oh, and Natalie Short, who is all about protecting the Second Amendment, says that there should be some type of limit to the amount of ammunition that a person has in their possession at any one time. Oh, but she's all about protecting the Second Amendment. It's really weird because all of those things seem more about going after legal, law-abiding gun owners. They don't seem to be about protecting the Second Amendment at all. They seem to be about restricting what I, as a legal gun owner, can do. How many firearms I can purchase, how much ammunition I can own, what type of magazines I am allowed to possess. Natalie Short, who admits she's not a gun owner, but again, says she's all about protecting the Second Amendment, said if a person owns one gun, they don't need to be able to have hundreds of rounds. If a person has five guns, they don't need to have 1,000 rounds at one time. So that means if you're Natalie Short, it's five guns, you don't need 1,000 rounds at one time. Okay, so let's say one of your guns is a .22, right? And you buy a box of 500 rounds of .22 long rifle. Okay, so that's now 500 rounds for your .22. Now you've got 500 rounds. Oh, well, actually, you don't need to have 1,000 rounds. So that's not what you would be allowed to own under Natalie Short's proposal or what she wants to dream up. Maybe for your five firearms, maybe she says you can have a 500 rounds. You can have 100 rounds per firearm. And again, are we going to keep track of this? Are we now going to monitor ammunition sales in Virginia? What are we going to do when the computer tells us, oh my gosh, somebody has purchased 2,000 rounds in the last 3 months? Are you going to have a limit as to how many rounds of ammunition you can purchase at a time? I don't know how on earth you're going to enforce a law that says you can only possess so many rounds of ammunition at one time. How are you going to do that? You got to go into gun owners' homes. First of all, in Virginia, we don't have gun registration, so how are you going to know where the gun owners are? But are you then going to go into our homes and try to figure out how much ammo we have on hand? And if you think that's, A, not only protecting the Second Amendment, but protecting the Fourth Amendment, you got another thing coming. You know, again, this is something that's being billed as a quote-unquote common-sense gun safety measure. Until you actually think about, okay, what would it look like to try to implement this proposal? And what does it actually mean? If you're out there calling for stuff like this, saying, well, I just don't think you should be able to own that much ammunition, in what way, shape, or form do you are you totally about supporting our right to keep and bear arms? Anyway, just a snapshot at how the Second Amendment issue is playing out in one legislative race here in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Don't forget, no matter where you live, you can actually volunteer here to help out in Virginia. We've got anti-gun billionaires who don't live in Virginia who are certainly doing everything they can to try to influence the election in this state. So if you would like to help defend our right to keep and bear arms, make sure you go to NRAILA.org, click the grassroots division tab, and you can get more information. All right, we're going to step away for just a moment or two, but when we come back, we've got a legislative update out of Ohio for you. Later in the hour, Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media. Stick around. There's more Cam and Company coming up after this quick break.
So we're talking to Kevin Graham of Securit. You have a very impressive booth here. Talk about Securit. What do you guys do?
Well, at Securit, we're trying to get people to rethink the way that they store their firearms throughout their home. Gun safes haven't really changed over the last 50 years, and what we want to try to do is get people to think differently about where they store their firearms, how they store their firearms, and the things that they're storing their firearms with. One of the main topics we've been talking about this weekend has actually been the concept of decentralized storage. So not having all of your firearms stored in one central location within your house. For a home defense scenario, you're going to want to have stuff scattered throughout the house. So in the master bedroom, in a guest bedroom, a front hallway closet, even the dining room or a kitchen pantry, having something like a fast box storage system is going to give you a great tactical advantage.
Yeah, so show us how it works.
Okay, so we have two styles of the fast box. We have a Model 47, which is just 47 inches tall or long, along with a Model 40, which is 40 inches. Now, they don't come standard for a vertical kit application. Those are sold separately. But the way they work is if you install a vertical kit, you're going to have enough space in there for two long guns, so rifles, shotguns. And with a Model 47, you're going to have additional room in there for some bins, accessories, and even if you wanted to do a pistol peg system, you can install that as well. Now, standard, they come meant for a horizontal application, so storing underneath the bed, you can secure them straight to your bed frame, you can bolt them to the floor, you can bolt them to the wall, however you prefer to do it. Personally, I recommend bolting them straight to the bed frame so they're not going to go anywhere. And the way it works is it's a simple keypad of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 button clicks, turn and go. There's also a key ride over system, so you're going to have no problem getting into that. They're easily hidden, so anybody breaking in is going to have a difficult time to find it, because the one thing we always say is the one safe a thief can't break into is the one that they don't know you have. Yeah. So they're easily secured under the bed, inside of a hallway closet. Fast access, easy access, tactical advantage is what you're going to want.
That's great. Well, it's awesome stuff. You have a booth full of stuff here. People want to find out more on their website. Where do they go?
SecureGunStorage.com.
Fair enough. Thank you, Kevin. Yeah,
thank you.
I'm speaking with Ray Fowler with Mean Arms. What is Mean? What's it all about?
Well, Mean Arms, we're out of Woodstock, Georgia, and we're injection molders by profession. We love guns and coming up with solutions, so we've got a lot of smart folks, engineers in-house, and we came up with a better way to load an AR-15, if you can believe that.
I just love people who are in other industries that come up with cool ideas for guns because they're gun guys. You always come with the greatest stuff, so let's see what you got.
Well, this is really cool. So really, the idea was born out of California and New York, where they have the restrictions where they have to pin or fix their magazine in place. So fortunately, we're in Georgia. We don't have those restrictions yet, but we truly came up with a better way to load it, and I'm going to show you how it works here. So this is the loader. It's an MA loader. It has 10 rounds, and this is a 10-round magazine, and really it just fits right into the ejector port. So when people come by and they see it, they're like, what exactly is that? Because it just looks so odd for it in there. But it locks into the ejector port, and it's this fast to load. So load. And then that is loaded. So,
wow.
Really, the cool part is from, you know, it goes from that to having a loaded magazine. It's just an unbelievable way to go to the range. So now,
that,
you know, in
6
months in Georgia, I haven't taken the magazine out. I go to the range and shoot.
Oh.
And this thing doesn't have a spring. So whenever you actually load it, it's just very, it's a pleasure. I'm not pushing a thumb against the spring, and it's it truly is a better way to load an AR-15.
So where did this idea come from? How did it come about?
I would love to take credit, but actually one of the owners and one of my partners, he is a smart engineer. I fly airplanes for a living, so I'm usually the dumbest guy in the room. But these guys have come out with a great innovative way to do a lot of different things in the gun industry. So everything Mean Arms is going to be innovative. We've got some other stuff coming out, and it's just, again, we were thinking this would be for California, New York, but we're selling them in all 50 states. People just love it. And it just started this month. I mean, this is the first month we've actually had the product.
How to get more information about Mean Arms?
MeanArms.com is our website.
Thanks for being with us.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having us.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, your first source for Second Amendment news and information. Coming to you from a beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia today. Stephen Kruiser of PJ Media joins us on the program in just a little bit. But right now, I want to welcome to the program Sean Maloney, member of the Buckeye Farms Association, NRA board member as well. Sean, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing great, Cam. How about yourself?
I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. I did see this story today out of Cincinnati. And I guess it's sort of a dual story. It's out of Cincinnati and it's out of Columbus because you've got legislation in Ohio, House Bill 228, Senate Bill 180, and you've got a Cincinnati City Council member, Christopher Smitherman, who is a concealed carry holder. He said, at a City Council meeting, he said, I had one situation the last 2 years where I was attacked and I didn't have my firearm at the time of the attack, but it was very dangerous and the possibility of retreating wasn't there for me. Despite the fact that this concealed carry holder had an incident where he really wished that he had his firearm, he joined his colleagues on the Cincinnati City Council to send a resolution to Columbus opposing House Bill 228 and Senate Bill 180. What are these bills all about, Sean?
Well, the bills are removing the duty to retreat in Ohio, also clarifying when you have to inform a police officer that you're carrying a firearm, and some other provisions of the Ohio law we've just been trying to clean up. And, you know, Chris Smitherman, he's kind of a loud member of the city council down there. And unfortunately, some of the most dangerous people that we have that we face as gun proponents and as civil rights advocates are the gun owners that are anti-gun, because people assume that for whatever reason they seem to know something more than we know. And that's not the case.
No, absolutely not. Now, at least one of these bills has made some progress this week. Is that right? Was this House Bill 228?
Yeah, House Bill 228 has about five or six key provisions, and House Member Representative Wiggum's bill has been voted out of the House successfully, and that deals with promptly informing a police officer that you're carrying a firearm if you have a meaningful contact. And what that is, Cam, is if you're pulled over for a traffic violation and you're a concealed carry holder, the law states that you have to promptly inform the police officer. Unfortunately, promptly means something different to all of us. And so we as law-abiding gun owners never really knew what was prompt and what wasn't. Sometimes as soon as we were asked for our driver's license registration, we would include our concealed carry permit, and that was fine, but other times you'd be arrested for that. So that just kind of clarifies and draws a bright line for us, so to speak, as gun owners. And now as when the police officer asks you for identification, you must also inform them that you're a concealed carry holder and you have your firearm with you if that's the case. So that was the first part, and I thought that would move last session, and for whatever reason it didn't. But this time it was voted out of the House and is headed over to the Senate, and I expect that to pass and be on the governor's desk.
All right. Well, that is good news. I mean, honestly, Sean, it sounds like, you know, you called these sort of cleanup measures. I mean, Ohio's right to carry law went into effect in 2004. Is that correct?
That's correct. And
so
and
I know yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we passed that legislation with Bob Taft, who was a Republican governor, who actually vetoed everything we put in front of him several times. And it took a veto override to actually pass concealed carry. So things like removing the duty to retreat in the state of Ohio, we have the Castle Doctrine. We have no duty to retreat in our cars, in our automobiles, in our homes, or in a home we have a legal right to be in, but we have a duty to retreat everywhere else. So we're just trying to normalize that and clean that up. And then actually, you may or may not know this, Ohio is the only state in the United States that places the burden of proof in a self-defense case on the defendant. So me as a gun owner, law-abiding gun owner, if I use self-defense to protect my family and my home, I have the burden to show by preponderance of evidence first that I reasonably use the firearm. And then the prosecution has a burden by a reasonable doubt to prove that I didn't. We're the only state that has that, and it only applies to the affirmative defense of self-defense in Ohio. The burden is the normal burden in every other crime there is. The burden is on the prosecution to prove the elements. So that's something that's been needed to be taken care of for a long time, and that seems to be making progress also.
That is good news. And you know, again, I mean, since 2004, I know that there have been several other reform bills. You've gone back and you've had these sort of cleanup measures. It's odd to me that this a concealed carry holder who's a member of the city council would be so vociferous in arguing against these measures that are reasonable. They're frankly fairly small issues, I think, all things considered. And, you know, again, provides clarity for people like himself as a concealed carry holder. Okay, so what do you do if you're pulled over in a traffic stop, right? Well, now you've got that additional clarity as opposed to the ambiguity of the law as it stands right now. I don't know a single concealed carry holder who is in favor of ambiguous laws versus laws that are crystal clear and easy to follow.
I think if Mr. Smitherman stepped back and listened to what he said and looks at the fact that he's a concealed carry holder and he is directly constitutionally benefited by these changes, he should change his mind. But that kind of gives you part and parcel of the problem that we have in a lot of government and maybe throughout the United States, that partisan politics becomes bigger and overriding than anything else. Common sense no longer makes sense, and the constitutionality doesn't matter because, you know, I have a certain agenda. And I think it's probably a great example of that right here. And, you know, Mr. Smitherman's been loud about issues. And actually, you know, I was happy to learn that he's a concealed carry holder, and certainly he needed it on occasion. And then to come out and say, I'm for it, but I'm against anything to make it better, really makes it no sense.
I'm with you. At that point, you know, I don't agree with the folks who say, oh, we shouldn't have concealed carry, but I can understand objecting to concealed carry reforms if you are opposed to people legally carrying a firearm. But to me, if you are a concealed carry holder, yeah, you want to work to make that law you want that law to be as good as it can be.
All we want to do is make it uniform and make it easy to constitutionally apply our rights and to look out for rights. And I've talked to, as a criminal defense attorney, I've talked to dozens of police officers, and we talk about promptly informing all the time. You know, what's that mean? I tell clients and I advise people in my seminars, roll your window down at night. Turn your dome light on, your hands are on the steering wheel, and no matter what the police officer is saying, and I know our mothers taught us not to interrupt anybody, but you need to interrupt the police officer and say, I am a concealed carry holder, and I have it with me.
Sean Maloney with Buckeye Firearms Association. So what are you encouraging members of Buckeye Firearms to be doing right now to help these bills along, Sean?
They're in caucus, so it's time to start ringing the phones and make sure that our legislatures and senators especially now start hearing from us. And another provision of the bill was interesting, Cam. You hear us talking about FASTER program. It's a law in the state of Ohio that if you're a prohibited area, meaning you can't carry a firearm, say, in a school safety zone, it's illegal to carry a firearm unless the school gives permission. Well, these schools still have to post no gun signs. And I would leave a school board meeting. They would pass guns in the school zone and arm their teachers, and they weren't legally allowed to take the no gun signs down. And they say, hey, look, we want the public to know, you know, this isn't a gun-free zone. We're armed, and we're protecting our children. So that piece of legislation is in there also. So now they can take that no gun sign down if they allow concealed carry in a premises and not be charged with an offense under the Ohio Revised Code.
Oh, well, that would be good for these school districts. And it seems like there are more and more of these school districts around the state of Ohio. So it would be good to get that taken care of for them as well. All right, Sean, listen, man, I appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you so much for your insight and look forward to talking to you again. Hopefully when these bills become law, if not before.
I'm hopeful it won't be long, and I expect to see him on the governor's desk. So thanks a lot, Cam, for keeping track of us and putting the word out there.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Sean Maloney with Buckeye Firearms Association, member of the NRA's Board of Directors, talking about the latest in the Buckeye state of Ohio. Stephen Cruiser of PJ Media going to be with us here in just a couple of minutes as well. Now, in Arizona, Let's quickly talk about something from the other side here. You've got anti-hunting groups in Arizona that are launching a campaign trying to start a ballot initiative that would ban the hunting and trapping of mountain lions and bobcats in the state of Arizona. Yeah. This is a group called Arizonans for Wildlife. Apparently, they've got the backing of groups like HSUS, which is not your local Humane Society shelter, by the way. Center for Biological Diversity, that is the group that tried to ban lead ammunition and lead shot through the Toxic Substances Control Act, tried to actually sue the EPA demanding that they ban lead ammo, lead shot through the Toxic Substances Control Act. The Animal Legal Defense Fund, working on this as well. They have until July of next year to gather 150,642 valid signatures to place the initiative on the November 2018 ballot. In Arizona right now, Arizona Game and Fish manages the wildlife populations. They have a game management plan that is designed to ensure stable populations of even predators in the area, including mountain lions and bobcats. There is no risk, no chance, and no effort to eradicate mountain lions and bobcats in the state of Arizona. Look, you might have some ranchers who would love to see them disappear, but that's not part of the management plan. They want to see these populations stable and healthy. Again, they want to manage the population numbers of these predators along with the other game species, but they don't want to eradicate them, which is the big claim, of course, by anti-hunters, that we're just going to hunt these predators into extinction. No, we've actually learned quite a bit about game management since conservation became a thing more than 100 years ago. And so, no, that's not the design. It's not the intent. It's not even an unintended consequence. There's no chance of that happening. But there is a chance of being able to actually hunt bobcats and mountain lions in Arizona going away if this ballot initiative were to pass. So we'll be keeping our eyes on that anti-hunting initiative in California, in Arizona. Sounds like a California proposal, but no, it's already moved east a little bit to Arizona. We'll be paying attention to what's going on in Arizona here in the coming months. When we return after a quick timeout, Stephen Kruiser from PJ Media, he'll be with us on the program. So stick around. There is much more Cam and Company still to come right after this.
Here at SHOT Show with Kellyanne Pidgeon of Armed and Feminine. So obviously, there's so much to talk about with women and guns and women shooting. Where are we right now? We're talking about 2017. We're talking about being at a show with so much representation of women, so many women here. This is such a burgeoning industry in general, but for women, it's huge right now.
Loving it. We still see male-dominated, especially here. I was coming over and I said, now I know what the salmon feel like, you know, swimming upstream. And that's sort of what the women's movement has been like until recently. You know, we've been the salmon swimming upstream, but we've really begun to be embraced by a lot of the manufacturers now, and it had been a struggle for a long time, and we're just a soaring force, and we have so many wonderful ladies organizations right now that are promoting that. And what's even nicer is that, like I said, the manufacturers are responding to us just in terms of holsters that fit us, guns that are lighter weight, things that just better fit our bodies, education for women, which is really, really big from a lot of the organizations that I deal with, a lot of education and empowerment for women. So we're on the move, and we're here to stay, and it's a wonderful thing.
Well, you say you're here to stay, but, you know, let's be honest. We know that women drive shopping decisions. We know that women drive household decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Women, they pick where you're going to go on vacation, you know.
Pretty much.
So you guys, you control a lot of the spending dollars.
And the checkbooks.
It's where you go, everything else goes, correct?
Yeah. And actually, last year, I think I said to John, too, you know, what the mom and the matriarch and the family believes, so will her children. And so the more women that we get involved in believing this, her children will just, you know, through osmosis growing up, mm-hmm. are going to learn that and respect all of that and continue all of this. And so when we say women will save the Second Amendment, that's why, not just the checkbook, but what Mama believes the rest of the family will do too.
So you talked about the manufacturers, and of course you're here and meeting with everybody.
Right.
Some of the women we talk to in this industry, they complain about the shrink it and pink it factor, where they all they do is make it smaller for your hands, and they put they slap pink on it. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I love pink.
Controversy.
I love pink, but all of my guns are black or the sand color. I own no pink guns. I would have to agree. There were some fellas here that I met with last year, and I loved their holsters. Their concept was fantastic. And I said to him, look, you need to move this clip a little bit because we have different pants, hip bones. And so he actually got from the third floor to the second floor, first floor this year. And I said, hey, did you move it? And no, he didn't. So I'm like, did you forget about me? So he's actually making one specifically for me with some ideas that I gave him, and my other girlfriend was with me too, and we're like, this is what we have. He's like, all right, I'm going to make that now. But right, shrink it and
pink it
is not necessarily where we are.
Right.
So there, when we look at women, we have so many different body types, heights, widths, you know, curves. They almost need a whole specific line, mm-hmm. you know, to do that. So step by step, we're getting there. I have found a lot more product out on the floors this SHOT Show rather than last that is a lot more tailored mm-hmm. to our needs and really enjoying it.
Yeah.
Really enjoying
when you
it.
Talk about getting women involved, you know, they come mm-hmm. to you first, say, hey, how do I, what do I do? What's, you know, elevator speech, how should women get involved in the shooting sports?
Find a trainer.
Yeah.
Find a trainer. I train women from, you know, 18 years old. I think my oldest has been 80. I actually did one class where 10 women, the youngest one was 64 years old, to 80. Yeah, and it was one of the most fun classes that we ever had. They want to learn. They want to do it correctly. They want to be safe. Mm-hmm. The first thing they want to do is be safe. And we always going to say, you know, don't go to Uncle Buck up camp to teach you. Find somebody who is trained, find a trainer, and learn it, because we need to touch things. Like, what is this called? What does it do? How does it work? Where are the directions? And Uncle Buck doesn't always teach those kinds of things. Right. And safety is always on the minds and the forefront of women. So certainly find a trainer. You know, a lot of the organizations have them right online. Even when we go to NRA.org, and we can find a class, and you can look specifically if you want a woman. Mm-hmm. A lot of women, what I've learned, feel better or more comfortable, less intimidated with female instructors mm-hmm. because they feel like they're not going to get shut down or look stupid.
I'm
not going to look stupid. Exactly.
It's the same thing there.
Exactly.
The women-only gyms.
Right. And actually, I'm starting into my third season, and I only did it very, very part-time the first season. I doubled the number of women that I trained the second season, and I'm going to double that again this year. I just, like, can't even keep up, which is a wonderful thing because we're starting that. Well, it's a grassroots movement. You know, do this all locally, and we find that they just can't get enough of it, and they want more training, and they want to do everything correctly. I actually have two students who are going to NRA instructor training this coming weekend.
Welcome back to Cam and Company on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Join us on the program right now, the Steve Perry of Tracked and Targeted. Not the Greg Raleigh, not the Neil Schoen. No. The Steve Perry of Tracked and Targeted. Steven Cruiser of PJ Media is with us on the program. Steven, how are you, sir?
I'm being replaced for the Tracked and Targeted revival. No.
There's a guy who lives in the Philippines who sounds exactly like you, Steven. It's amazing.
Oddly, he looks like me, too.
I appreciate that you coming on the program. Let's just get to your latest piece at PJ Media. Tapper reaffirms hack status, compares Trump to McCarthy. That would be Joseph McCarthy, Melissa McCarthy, right?
I didn't go through the entire interview. He may have gotten to her at the end as a double team kind of thing, but no, it was Joseph McCarthy, yeah.
Okay. This was on the hard-hitting Stephen Colbert show. Is that correct?
Yes, last night. It was. Tapper has mystified me for years because, you know, I'm hip-deep in online politics, as you are, and so many people on our side, so many conservatives like this guy. They think he's one of the good guys in the mainstream media, and he's not. He just comes with, he does his weekend little shouts to the troops, which kind of gives, makes him more palatable than other left-leaning media people.
Mm-hmm.
But the second he has a chance to, like, go after a Republican online or go after, he does. He's as bad as the rest of them. And for some reason, he's got some kind of spell that he's cast on conservative activists who think that he's, like, say, better than Chuck Todd. I don't think he is.
As you say, Jake Tapper, he does tweet out his support for the military. He wrote a book, The Outpost, I believe it was, about a firefight in Afghanistan that a friend of Cam and Company, Clinton Romache, was involved in. But every now and then he'll take a dig at someone on the left, and I guess that makes people on the right say, ooh, wow, that's great. Look at Jake Tapper go. But he was a guy who also interned, I think, for the Brady campaign way back when. Not somebody who is, straight down the middle. Maybe somebody who's a little bit more open about his biases, but I don't think that's it either.
No, I think what it is, I think it's quite the opposite. I think, like, say, I mentioned Chuck Todd. Chuck Todd's more open about his bias. Tapper has this fog of something around it, pretending that he's not as biased, and I think people are buying it. But he's done things online. I've seen him take up, like, personal squabbles that aren't in the news yet, that haven't made it to CNN, that he wouldn't be talking about on his show, but get involved with retweeting them, digs at certain Republicans, digs at certain conservatives, and he does that quite frequently. I just pay attention to more of that than most people. But this McCarthyism thing is one of these classic lefty things. You know, anytime they don't like a loud Republican, he's reminiscent of Joe McCarthy. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is not a new thing. This is something they've been doing since Joe McCarthy. And the thing is, the thing that they never get to anymore, and something that I've been saying since I was in my 20s, which then Ann Coulter went on to elaborate about in her book Treason, is that McCarthy was right, okay? The evidence is there now. He wasn't some loon just barking into the clouds. There were commies all over the American government, throughout American society, and he was going after them. Now, the methods may not have always been sound, but what Tapper's describing here really only is valid if you presume McCarthy was wrong, but he's not. That's their go-to. That's their intellectually lazy attack on any loud Republican they don't like is McCarthyism.
I agree with you that's the intent. It's interesting because when you say McCarthy was right, it's kind of like people saying, take Donald Trump seriously but not literally. Right. There was, and I think that same attitude can apply towards Joe McCarthy. Was he sloppy?
Yeah,
he was really sloppy.
Was he a drunk?
Did he make claims that he could not back up? Yes. In fact, I would say that McCarthy, the damage that McCarthy did was that he was a kind of a buffoon, and he was sloppy, and he took a legitimate issue and he made it so that it was easy to dismiss it because of Joe McCarthy. Right. But, McCarthy came along in 52, I think it was when he first started talking about anti-communism. I mean, you had going back to the late 30s, you had the House Un-American Activities Committee that was taking a look at both fascism and communism in the United States, 1948. You had Whitaker Chambers come forward as a former communist. Elizabeth Bentley had come forward that same year. So, you had years and years of people who were coming out and testifying to individuals who had, again, joined a party that swore allegiance not to the United States but to a foreign government. It was trying to bring about a revolution in the United States and to tear down the Constitution and to bring in a whole new style of government. You did have that exposure years before McCarthy. And McCarthy, I think, glommed onto that real issue. And then because of his tactics and his habits, made it easy to say, this is completely overblown. But you're right. When the left uses that phrase, what they mean is witch hunt, right? They mean making up stuff out of whole cloth, and it's just a witch hunt.
The left often conflates the House Un-American Activities era with the McCarthy era, too.
Mm-hmm.
That happens all the time. There's nobody's paying attention that it's two different chambers of Congress. But that happens quite frequently, too. And I just think
I think if you're trying to draw actual parallels between Trump and McCarthy, it's tenuous at best. I mean, but it's one of these things, the way he tossed it out there, Colbert lapped it up, the audience lapped it up, people were lapping it up because nobody knows what anybody's talking about. This is what the left gets away with all the time. They throw out these little things like this, these little things that they've worked into the conversation for decades that are practically meaningless, but they're now used to bolster points. This is what we're up against. We're up against this war of words, and the other side has made all of their words mean something over decades because of their stranglehold on pop culture, and they don't mean anything. And then we have to come in with facts, and nobody wants to listen to facts.
Yeah, I wish that we could accuse people who do this of Durantism, Stephen. But I'm afraid again, you know, as you say, the who controls the culture, right? Not too many Americans are going to get that reference to the former New York Times reporter Walter Duranty.
How many Durante scenes have you seen in movies in the last 20 years versus how many McCarthy or House on American Activities movie scenes have you seen in movies?
Exactly right. But it is interesting, and I'm glad that you were calling out Jake Tapper for this, the McCarthyism reference. What else has been on your radar at PJ Media over the last couple of days?
Well, I've been filling in for the video editor, which is why I haven't written much lately. So I've just been posting videos. And of course, I get drudge hits off of those. You know, I pour my heart and intellect into writing things, and I get no drudge hits. I write three sentences about a video that I pulled somewhere, and it's drudge. So I'm writing something about Jeff Flake, because this is a story I've been following. I'm from Arizona originally. I still have a lot of friends in the Arizona GOP. Most of my friends there are conservative and Republican voters. So I've been following Flake's entire career, which has been a disappointment since he got into the Senate. And I'm writing something right now about the swooning liberal media reaction to his principled speech yesterday and what's really going on and why he's really bowing out. And then I'm going to do a Facebook live video for PJ Media exploring it a little further when I'm done writing the post.
Excellent. I look forward to reading that. I was actually hanging out with an Arizonan talking a little bit about Arizona politics earlier in the week. And, you know, that's a fascinating state. I'll be very curious to see how this plays out. But, you know, it is interesting, too, because you talk about the media reaction to Senator Flake's speech yesterday. I saw a story earlier today. Actually, this was our very first thing that we mentioned on the show. The editor of Huffington Post Politics was tweeting out a poll, and I don't know what outfit did this poll, but according to this poll, Democrats, Stephen, now have a positive view of George W. Bush, 51% to 42%. 51% positive impression, 42% negative impression of the guy that they called Bush Hitler and Chimpy McSmirk when he was in office.
War criminal, too. Don't forget that.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah.
And now he's at 51% approval among Democrats.
Well, the Democrats, bless them, this is why I refer to them as the party of eternal sunshine of the spotless mind. Once something's out of their sight, you know, they don't reference history past when it's convenient for them. So right now, I would say they normally do that. This is a special situation right here because they are working overtime to have you believe that the vitriol and the anger that they have right now all was born in the Trump era. And they want you to forget that they treat every Republican candidate or president like this. It's a little magnified right now, but they used to savage Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And they savaged Romney, who they now universally laud as one of the nicest men in politics.
Yeah.
But when he was running for president, he was a bullying animal abuser who gave a woman cancer.
Literally a Nazi. And binders full of women, right?
Yeah. Yeah, sexist too. So they're trying to do this revisionist history, pretending like, oh, these were such good guys and they were friends. Bill Maher's the only one who was honest about it. He was going like, I thought not Romney was bad. What was wrong with me? So, you know, he at least admitted, he goes, and he talked about how he used to talk about Romney. So at least he was honest about that. But most of them want you to believe that, oh, we just thought these guys were nice guys, but this Trump guy, we knew he was a bad egg from the beginning.
Yeah. Isn't that weird how it always works that way? You get out of office and immediately, you know, the approval ratings start climbing. I didn't, you know, just odd. When you're in office, again, you're the worst person ever. But as soon as you get out, you're no longer a monster. Crazy how that works.
Well, yeah, and there, you know, nobody does revisionist history quite like the American left.
Now we get back into flagrant Durantism again, Stephen.
Yes.
All right, listen, man, we are unfortunately almost out of time, but I will be checking out the videos at PJ Media, and I won't even wait till they appear on Drudge. I'll just go straight to PJ Media, get them there first.
I'm mostly still in the video section for the next week, but I'm going to write this article. This article and this Facebook Live thing should all be done in the next 2 hours.
Excellent. All right, well, we will let you get back to it. Thanks again for coming on the program today, sir. It's good talking with you.
Good talking to you, too. Have a good one.
You, too. Stephen Kruger joining us from PJ Media. Stephen Kruger on Twitter. That's Stephen with a PH. That is Kruger with a K. We will be talking with Stephen's friend Kurt Schlichter coming up on tomorrow's Cam and Company as well. Also, more of the day's top news and information. In the couple of minutes that we have left here, probably not going to be able to get to both of these stories. So some range-related news for you. We've got an update on a range in Massachusetts that has been, no pun intended, under fire recently. But in Livingston County, Michigan, there was a proposal to build a range that would be used to train law enforcement. So this wasn't even going to be a range that was going to be open, 7 days a week for civilians. This was a 300-acre range that was going to be used to train first responders. They had a meeting in Howell Township, Michigan this week. Nearly 50 people turned out in, quote, near unanimous disapproval. That from WHMI there in Livingston County. A commissioner said there's a lot to consider, but they'd have to be deaf not to hear the resounding consensus from the public. Another councilman said, yep, this is one of the few incidents where we've seen so much in unison feedback from the community. Now, the guy who wanted to build this range noted, look, I could get 100 of my friends out to my property every weekend. We could go shooting, and it wouldn't be a commercial range, and there's nothing you could do about it. I'm trying to set up a legitimate business that can provide a legitimate function and training for law enforcement, and unfortunately, the not-in-my-backyard mentality one out there in Livingston County. The range denied. It will not go forward. We'll see you with more Cam and Company tomorrow.